Dwayne Ford to kick off today. Dwayne, I'm going to call up your materials, but I want to check in. Would you like to leave the polls up a little bit longer to see if there are any last votes that may come in?
Sure, yeah, we can leave it up for a few minutes longer. I've been watching the reading suggestions come in, several great books that that I'm going to add to my backlog for my summer reading. I will say, though, that there are simply not enough margaritas to get me to read the Eigenvalues for Dummies book. Just not going to do it. But anyway, so yeah, we can leave that open for a couple more minutes. You know, I just want to say hello and welcome to such an outstanding day. It's springtime. My taxes are done. Heck, I'm even getting a tiny little refund. The Blue Bonnets are in full bloom. Baseball season's underway. The Texas Rangers are leading the American League West. You know, what could possibly make this a better day? Oh, I know what could make this a better day. An M2S2 webinar and a birthday. This is actually our 18th M2S2 webinar, and I think it's going to be an excellent one. And as far as the birthday, well, it's not precisely her birthday, but Jean Balance can be blowing out the candles this weekend, and she has been so terrific to work with on these webinars. I want to invite everyone to use the Q&A panel to wish her a happy birthday. So many thanks, Jean.
Oh, thank you. Thank you all so very much.
Today's seminar is focused on advanced geophysical classification, and you know this topic, it usually generates quite a bit of interest since most people starting to recognize that AGC, that it's poised to become the standard paradigm for how we conduct our munitions remediation, and the technology, you know, it's gone through exhaustive development and product testing. All of the geophysicists have emerged from the testing without so much as a scratch. So we are gearing up for production. This is our second seminar in 2016. You know, after today, we're going to pause for the seventh inning stretch. We'll resume play on August the 4th. And that August 4th webinar, that's going to focus on remedial investigation, feasibility studies with the Range Support Center organizing that particular session. And then on October 27th, we'll conclude the 2016 seminars with a session about decision making, and that one's going to be brought to you by the Omaha Military Munitions Design Center. Now, today's webinar, it was assembled and organized by the Huntsville Design Center, and we're going to be doing something a little bit different. We have a couple of intro and overview presentations, going to follow that up with some case studies, then an update on where we stand with accreditation, and we're going to conclude with a panel discussion of subject matter experts where they'll be able to answer everything you wanted to know about advanced geophysical classification. And, you know, this looks like a really good lineup and pitching staff, and I want to recognize Ralph Campbell with the CWM Design Center, the Huntsville Design Center folks, and Annie Schwartz for pulling all of this together. Jean, she'll be keeping an eye on everything, and I'm Dwayne Ford. I'll be doing my very best Vin Scully impersonation. Just a quick look at today's agenda. You know, as I mentioned, we're going to conclude today with an AGC panel discussion, so be sure to come back after the intermission. You know, usually they tell you that if you're lost, that you should stay put. But I say that if you're lost on a munitions response project, don't stay where you are. There's a really good chance that we've conducted a webinar that might help you get back on the path. So go to the archives, get your bearings, and find your way out of the wilderness. If you would, you know, please be sure to keep plugging away with the 3 R's explosive safety message to your stakeholders: recognize, retreat, and report. And with that, I just want to announce that our first batter in the lineup today is Mr. Fred Vreeman. Fred's with the Alaska Department of Environmental Conservation, and he's been involved with munitions response since around 08, and he's actively involved with ITRC. So, Fred, if you don't mind, give us an overview and regulator perspective on advanced classification.
Well, thanks, Dwayne. Thanks. And we're going to actually start this off with a video that sort of demonstrates what's being cleaned up. I know more than half of you are very involved in this project. You've probably heard some of these presentations before, but it doesn't hurt to go ahead and watch why we're here. So, Gene, if you'll go ahead and start that video. If you can't hear this because you're on the phone, you may want to just turn up your speakers on your computer.
All right, I'm about to hit play.
This video kind of demonstrates how we got to where we are, how metal debris basically gets scattered all over a training range. That's the best part. So my slides kind of define the problem for you. Our soldiers need to train for combat and test their weapons. Some of those rockets and shells don't blow up and they end up buried in the ground and out on the range where they're still explosive and very dangerous. Years later, we need to clean those areas up, and on live fire ranges there's going to be thousands of pieces of scrap metal, like you see in the graphic on the left over there. And maybe just a few live pieces of ordnance that didn't go off. Single axis sensors have been used for a long time. ITRC has been developing training and guidance on those for over 10 years. That's how I got into this project, through ITRC. You can see in the photo here what we call a sea of flags with thousands of pieces of metal detected below the ground that are located and then dug up. Well, cleaning up these munitions is a really big job. There's over 5,200 sites all over America, and half of them are going to need some kind of geophysical investigation. DoD realized early on that if we rely on the single-axis sensors, it's going to cost us billions of dollars, and we won't be done until sometime into the next century. So they're looking for a better way. Some of you may not have experience with classification. So we're going to go through some basics for those participants who sort of need a briefing on why we would go after this technology. Basically, this slide demonstrates that the multi-axis sensors, the new ones, have several advantages. We can figure out whether the object is the size and shape of a munitions item. Decisions can now be made to dig up only munitions-like items and to safely leave non-munitions items in the ground. The digging at the site is going to be significantly reduced, and of course that allows us to cover more area at a lower cost and with less disruption to the landowner. As you listen to the next presenters, you're going to hear some new technology if you haven't been introduced to this before. I'm going to go through a few terms in a couple of slides. But first of all, here's our definition of geophysical classification. But really, these pictures tell it better than words. We can tell from the data collected by our new multi-axis sensors whether an item in the ground is bomb-like, like the show on the left, or non-hazardous frag, like the scrap of metal on the right. We classify, that's one of the terms, the scrap metal on the right as not being a target of interest because the scanners can tell us with certainty it's not a bomb, so we don't have to dig it up. On this slide, you're going to see more of those targets. We found these by investigating anomalies in a geophysical investigation. Usually they're caused by metal objects encountered in our geophysical scan. And here's the decisions that we make on each one of those. The new multi-axis sensors basically allow us to make a dig or a no-dig decision based on whether we classify an object as a target of interest, and our acronym for that is TOI, you'll hear that again. So basically, TOI goes on a dig list, and non-TOI, like the frag and the horseshoe there, get left in the ground. Compared to using a single-axis sensor, you can see without this technology, we would have dug up the horseshoe and the scrap metal, and since 80% or more of the stuff at old training sites is scrap metal, we would have done a lot of unnecessary and very expensive digging. The next presenters are going to show you some real-world examples of how this classification works. The technology development for the sensors was an intensive 10-year program And then they were tested at many of these sites all across the country. You'll hear about a few of those. The early results, of course, were promising, and we realized early on that rigorous process and quality control is really critical to deploying this technology. So we've documented several cleanups where successful implementation and savings were demonstrated. Links to some of those demonstration projects are provided in an ITRC guidance document that I also do the training for, and there's going to be another training on that next week. Again, here's a sort of a glossary of terms. If you downloaded and printed the slides, you might want to keep this slide in front of you. On the next couple demonstration sites that I'll show you about, several of these underlying terms are going to be used. So here's an actual demonstration site. Single-axis sensors were compared to multi-axis sensors at this location. This geophysical mapping you see here was done with a single-axis sensor. That technology, of course, just finds all the metal, and you need to dig it up to figure out what it is or even how deep it's buried. In this area, more than 5,000 metal objects were detected that needed to be excavated, and only 16 were hazardous. Most of the items detected by our sensors were non-hazardous items. Moving to another site at that same Camp Siber, the Defense Department used geophysical classification. Here's the results. Similar, over 6,000 items were detected. Using single-axis sensors, we would have dug them all up. Using the new technology, the metal mapper that you see here deployed with a tractor, the software analysis told us, well, we got to dig less than 10% of those. So we dug 16% just to be sure, blind-seeded hundreds of dummy items called QACs to test the sensors and the process, found every one of those. The contractor also seeds items every day for quality control, and we call those QC seeds. In the process, at this site, we found three actual explosive mortars, which, of course, is what we were looking for. Just to be sure about our decisions, we dug up another 200 unique targets, plus another 400 or more of the targets that were classified as clutter, and that was to validate the technology. To be sure nothing was left there that was not classified correctly. All those quality assurance efforts told us that the technology had correctly selected which items needed to be dug. Okay, so here's why you want to know about this technology. With a multi-axis sensor, you're going to do a little more scanning and analysis, but you'll do a whole lot less digging on your site, and you'll probably have more confidence that you got all the unexploded ordnance. You won't be able to use this on every site. In fact, you're going to hear a case study a little bit later where maybe you have to take a different approach. But you'll learn that anywhere you might use a single-axis sensor, the new multi-axis sensors will do as well or better. The new technology will, of course, significantly reduce costs. That's the hope, anyway. You'll learn that we focus a lot more on surveys, engineering, computers, and quality control. But the overall cost savings could amount to billions of dollars. And most of that cost savings is from not having our EOD guys digging up hundreds of thousands of horseshoes and blown up car parts. And this project with ITRC, we got some regulators, Defense Department guys, consultants, and quality guys from all across the country into one room and basically came up with a guidance. And you might have some questions about how the technology works and what it works and where it works. Some of those answers could be found in the ITRC geophysical classification guidance that I'm showing you a link to right here on this slide. Here's a screenshot of the guidance. And you can sort of see how the guidance lays out. The key points that you'll find in the guidance are can be used to basically tell your constituents and to train some of your staff on just where to go for more information about the technology and basically how it works and where you can find additional information. Our team evaluated the technology and the quality assurance and accreditation program. And the ITRC team basically concluded that the technology is ready for deployment. There's really no more regulatory barriers to using this technology to clean up a site. And we produced some fact sheets and so forth that that told you about the and help you communicate some of this to your stakeholders. So today we're going to show you some of that software, and we're going to show you some of the sensor technology used to classify these objects as possibly hazardous TOI or non-hazardous, a non-TOI. I'm going to show you how those decisions are made and validated on each of these thousands of metal objects. You're going to learn some of the limitations of the technology. We're going to go in some detail about the quality controls necessary for successful implementation at the site. I've already started you on the terminology and acronyms. If you're not familiar with this technology, we're going to do more of that throughout today's webinar. Training is going to give you enough of an introduction so you can discuss this technology intelligently with your coworkers, stakeholders, and the people that are going to be responsible for cleaning up these sites. We're going to point you to some of the guidance and tools you'll need as you evaluate the technology. My role as a state regulator on the team was to basically evaluate the deployment of the technology, develop a process with the experts from the Defense Department and other state regulators that we could have confidence in. After today, we're hoping that you're going to be comfortable with the thought that by following a rigorous approach using these multi-axis sensors, we can safely leave some metal items in the ground after correctly classifying them as non-hazardous. The tools, length, and technical information you'll get from CERF and the SCCP are all referenced in some of the materials you'll see in the training today. And you'll know where to go for some of the information you need to make decisions at your site. So basically, I'm here as a state regulator telling you that I'm comfortable the technology works, and you can use it to figure out what needs to be dug up at your site. So our next presenter, Amy Walker, is going to step you basically through some more details on how the technology works.
Okay, very good. Fred, before we transition over to Amy, just a couple of quick questions. I'm wondering, as a regulator, what would you recommend to your fellow regulators that they need to become familiar with? You know, what areas of study or disciplines, what do they need to learn in order to get comfortable and educated about the advanced geophysical classification?
Well, the quality guidelines and the quality assurance processes are similar on a munitions site like this to those in the sort of chemistry world, but most of the regulators are only familiar with the chemistry world. So you've got to sort of re-educate them that these same processes are going to occur in the munitions response world, but the feedback loop, sort of they need to pay more attention to more immediate feedback loops and more immediate treating sort of nonconformance with some of the quality, because if you make a quality mistake, that's going to affect a large area. You want to catch it and take care of it right away. So I think more site visits, more attention to the project as it's occurring is one thing I'm trying to communicate to my regulator.
Okay, very good. And how do you feel that this technology, is it growing in the regulator community as far as people hearing about it and starting to understand it and working with it, getting comfortable? Is it still a fairly select set of regulators, or is the word spreading?
I think it's a very select set of regulators right now, particularly in the states where it'll probably be deployed first. We need to get the word out more. So the more we can sort of tell the regulators this is coming down the pike, have them sit through at least the ITRC training, which is just a very basic introduction, and more webinars like this, I think that'll be valuable as we move into the future. And I would say the same thing about the RPMs who will be dealing with some of these sites as well.
Okay, excellent. Well, and actually you segued into the last question that I wanted to put in front of you was, I was going to ask you if you wanted to put a plug in for the ITRC training. And Where can people go to access that? And do you have to register? Is it on demand? How does that all work?
Yeah, it's pretty much the same registration that you did, similar registration to what you did for this webinar, you would do for the training. There's actually one coming up next week, I think on the 28th, another one of our sort of live internet-based training. And then the trainings are also archived, so you can go to ClueIn, look for the trainings, and have your guys sit down and watch one of the archived trainings. And I'd almost suggest doing that as a little group, if you got three or four people in your office that need to be briefed, and then having a discussion about what more you might need to learn after watching that training. It's about 2 hours of training.
Excellent. Very good, Fred. Job well done. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Okay, well, I'll tell you what, let's move on to our next speaker then. And our next speaker is Amy Walker. Amy is with the Huntsville Center. She's a geophysicist, has worked for the center for a number of years, but has been one of the primary geophysicists kind of at the center of advanced classification as it has grown and evolved. Amy, she's an alumni of the Colorado School of Mines. So, Amy, give us an overview of the technology.
Okay, thanks, Dwayne. Since we realize that there are many of you on the line who are new to classification, I'm going to now just kind of build on what Fred has covered and provide a brief overview of classification technology. The slides that we're going to go through are borrowed heavily from those developed by ESTCP and ITRC as they do some of their training. Many of you will recognize these slides, and my apologies to those of you on the line who have heard this before. Now might be a good time to go get a cup of coffee or a quick snack before we get on to the case studies. So just quickly, we're going to cover how the sensors work, what you should expect, what they look like, how we use the data, and then how those decisions are made. Classification for munitions response is based on electromagnetic induction, which is the same as our previous industry kind of standby, the EM61. It works by running a current through a wire, the transmitter coil, which produces a time-varying magnetic field, and that's the red primary field that you see there. This induces eddy currents in a secondary field in any metal that's nearby. You can see that secondary field with the blue lines there. When we turn off that primary inducing field, then we listen with the receiver coil, which is how we get information about any metal and the targets that are below the coil. After turning it off, the induced field decays pretty rapidly, and how it does decay tells us something about the metal that's down there. Historically, our detectors, like the 61, have relied, as Fred mentioned, on these single, fairly large transmitter and receiver coils. This makes it difficult to fully illuminate the metallic items and get a good look at it from the different orientations, and it requires kind of stitching together many measurements from a moving sensor. That introduces some positioning error and makes it harder for us to determine too much about the piece of metal. We're going to kind of flip through a few screens here just to show how this problem can be overcome by using multi-axis, multi-coil sensors. In this example, you'll see energizing the three orthogonal coils. Sequentially, we can completely interrogate the buried object from a single measurement position. You can see the different color field lines show the different axes of the item being illuminated. And getting that full illumination, the different looks at the item is critical to being able to classify it. The same effect can be achieved by having multiple coplanar coils fired in sequence, which is how the TIMSATs work. So as we discussed, the previous sensors were not optimized for classification. We listened for a shorter time. The responses were averaged over a single larger coil. And that resulted in our inability to separate the useful information like size and shape from the location and just the geometry of the sensor, how deep the piece of metal was beneath the Earth's surface. That was all bound up together in the response. But now with these new sensors, they've been designed specifically to address this. illuminating from multiple angles, receiving at multiple locations, this all from a single data collection point gives us a lot more data than we had before. The fixed geometry also results in better geolocated data. And then again, we're listening over many more time windows to fully sample that decay curve. Now these classification sensors allow us to separate what we call the intrinsic properties of the metal size, shape, wall thickness from that location data and to use that information to make decisions on whether or not to dig. Here we have just some pictures of the four systems that are available today. There are various transmit and receiver geometries, but they all result in similar data sets, and they all are based on the same technology. The first one there is the Metal Mapper vehicle towed system. Then we have the TimTads 2x2 cart-mounted system. The MPV, man-portable vector, is the most maneuverable, kind of person-portable. And then now in the lower right hand is a picture of Geometrics new Metal Mapper 2x2, which I believe they're just now beginning to sell, which is basically their commercialized version of the TimTads. And again, they all have similar capabilities, just different platforms, which you should choose based on your individual site conditions. So what do we do with that data once we have it? I want you to look, as I kind of scroll between some slides here, look at the black bar that's representing an item under the coil. As it changes locations, you can see the blue raw data readings, the curves on the left, are changing significantly, but the polarizability curves, which are the ones on the lower right, are not changing. So that's really, that those curves are the ones, the information we're trying to extract from that raw data that we're now able to get to. So by inverting that raw data using the available software that we have, as I said, we're able to get to those intrinsic properties of the metal items that fully characterize the EMI signal, independent of sensor or geometry, and it contains all the information that we really need to be able to make those dig, no dig decisions. So there are several things that we can learn about a buried object by looking at the polarizability curve. The first thing we want to talk about is symmetry. Axially symmetric items, like most of the UXO that we're looking for, have one large primary curve on these images as red, and then two smaller equal curves, the blue and green. If they're not equal, on the example on the right, then we know that the item is not symmetric. Another property that we can determine just by looking at the curves is metal wall thickness. The thicker the metal, the longer it will hold on to that induced field, and the longer the signal will persist. We can see that if you look at the location and time on that bottom x-axis, the location of those red arrows, you can see that a thinner-walled item like that on the right, or items like wire or soda cans that very often clutter our sites, decay much faster than most of the ordnance that we're looking for. So again, that's a parameter that can let us make those dig, no dig decisions. Then the last parameter that we'll look at is just size. It's not always the case, but generally we can significantly decrease the amount of digging that's required simply by removing those shallow items that are too small to be targets of interest. And the amplitude of the polarizability, which you see on the y-axis there with the red arrows again, corresponds to the item size. And you can see what that might look like in the values. So one way that we analyze the data once we've collected it is by comparing it to a collection of responses for common munitions. And we call this the library. These are unique polarizability curves. We also refer to them sometimes as EMI fingerprints for each munitions item. The government, through ESTCP, is developing this library, has been adding to it, in the past year has collected measurements over many different items from ordnance museums across the country. The DoD has signed up to maintain this library and make it available to users in the future. So now, just quickly, we're going to talk about how we make those dig, no dig decisions, walking through these three ways listed here of how to get on the dig list. The first way to get on the dig list is to match a library item. We just talked about that large list of known munitions responses. The software that we have cycles through that library looking for a match. It will take the reading that you just collected, each individual reading, and compare it to every single item in the library and see how good of a match it is. You can see example here for a set of curves comparing to three different items in the library until it finds that match that's just right. And 90 to 95% of our decisions are made simply by this library matching. This is the easiest, most visual way to do it. Other decisions are made through additional analyses. We'll talk about those. The next step is to look for signatures that are similar to each other but may not be in the library. And we call this cluster analysis, or looking for clusters. Some of those clusters will be the items that we know we're looking for. But then again, we'll see some that don't match anything in the library, but there are several of them. So what we'll do is pick a representative item or items from that group and dig them up and see what they are. In this example, it ended up being a T-bar fuse, which the team decided was non-hazardous, that we didn't need to dig up the rest of them. So in that case, it's easy to remove all of those curves that match that item and take them off the dig list. If it had been an actual item of interest, then that signature could be added to the library and the remainder of the items in that group would be dug. Many times when munitions function as intended, we will see clusters of similar munitions debris, such as this fuse or base plates, and this is a good way to confidently avoid digging those. Then the last step is to look for just any really big, symmetric, thick-walled items. Anything that looks like the curve on the screen now is going to go on the dig list because it just has properties of many of the UXO items we're looking for. The things we talked about, seeing the symmetry, the large size, and the long decay, all of those things tell us that this is something that we should investigate. And we can look at the curves as we're doing here. But we also sometimes look at these things in what we call feature space, which is basically just looking at a plot of size versus decay. And anything that's in that region of large size, large decay, will trigger an additional review and possibly be added to the dig list. So UX Analyze, which is available through Geosoft's Oasis Montage and UXO Lab, are two software platforms that have the capability to handle the kind of data that we've been talking about. Both have been used successfully. They do provide some different products and maps, but they use the same underlying concepts of dipole inversion, the getting the polarizability curves, and library matching. UX Analyze is the industry standard software. Development has been funded by DoD to provide some of the standard data products that are in line with the QAP requirements. And processing of this data is now largely automated. We get the model inversions, the library match, and there are even some default thresholds set for decision making. These are settings that have proven applicable for a wide range of projects. But as with any time we do automated processing, you need to have that qualified geophysicist reviewing those results and determining if those settings are appropriate for the particular site conditions that you're running into. But at the end of the day, this results in a ranked list from most likely to least likely TOI with a dig, no dig decision, and nice image plots to convey those results. with that, I will wrap it up, and I wanted to offer these links to some really great additional information if you want to learn more. Hopefully this has been helpful as an overview for some of the new people, and the rest of you can wake back up now and get ready for the interesting part as we move on to some recent case studies.
Excellent. Very good, Amy. And I'll tell you what, and I meant to mention this earlier during my introduction. You know, usually during our webinars, we have an open question and answer session at the end of the webinar to try to cover any questions that we haven't covered during the presentations. And because we're having a panel discussion today, we're not going to do that. We're going to save all of our time for the panel discussions. But for any of our individual presentations, if we have time within the presentation, we'll get to questions that might be submitted. But we also have the speakers, their information, their contact information is posted. So if you have a question that you want to get in touch with one of the speakers, then please, by all means, feel free to do so. So with that, it's time we need to move on to our next speaker. And our next speaker is going to be John Baptiste. And John, he's Parsons' leading geophysicist. He's been very active with the advanced classification, has worked on a number of different projects. And John, tell us what y'all did out at Marpy Point and what you learned.
Okay, so this is a case study for a classification treatability study Parsons performed as part of an RIFS at the Marpy Point Field MRS in Saipan. The historic photo on the left shows the at least mostly completed airfield sometime during or soon after World War II. The other photo was taken from the top of the cliff. You can see in the historic photo and shows what's left of the airfield, which currently isn't much. On the ground, you can still see some of the evidence of the taxiways and some building remnants, but at this point, the site is mostly jungle. It's a 410-acre MRS that started out as an intended second Japanese airfield on the island. It was still under construction when the U.S. invaded from the south end of the island and ended up being the site of the Japanese last stand as the invasion pushed north. Once the island was captured, it was used as an ordnance staging point for the possible invasion of Japan, and there was a large ammunition depot adjacent to the airfield. Well, the airfield was only used until 1947 and abandoned in 1950. The Army used the area for demolition operations a couple of times. Last one was in the late 60s when a contractor cleared almost 4 million pounds of UXO from the area around Marpy Point outside of the FUDs. EOD teams during that demo op used Bonsai Cliff here as a demolition location for that clearance. Munitions mentioned in the CSM before we got out there included projectiles from 20 millimeters to 5 inches and 81 millimeter mortars. But given the invasion and the use of the site for demo, nearly anything was possible. This sea mine down here was an example of the anything. It wasn't found near the site, but some locals did have our site manager in Success go look at it after they found it digging the foundation for a resort. There's a lot of tourist traffic in the MRS, although it's generally limited to the roads and cleared areas given the extremely thick brush on the site. So the tourist areas are mostly here and here along these roads. This is a cemetery, veterans and locals cemetery, which is mostly unused at this point. But those are really the only areas that are highly trafficked. Plan for the RI was pretty standard, included a full site transect survey followed by a division of the site into likely clean and likely potentially contaminated areas based on anomaly density. We'd then try and confirm that the likely clean areas were actually clean and determine the nature and extent of contamination in the potentially contaminated areas. Problem with that plan was that we didn't find any low density areas. The lowest anomaly density measured in the transect survey is around 300 anomalies per acre. We also kept finding MEC on the surface during brush cutting. So we ended up considering the entire site contaminated with a revised goal of determining the nature and depth of the contamination. past concluding that the entire site was likely contaminated, determining the extent of contamination was limited to the FUD's boundary, because everything outside of the designated FUDs is just considered a war zone in this case, and the government is not currently clearing that up, so the FUD's boundary was not going to be extended. Most of the RI data was collected with a 61 and EM61, although there was some planned overlap between the classification 10 TADS data and EM61 data in a couple of the RI grids. Classification treatability study included 4 acres covering approximately 4 grids covering approximately 3.85 acres placed to cover the various vegetation types and anomaly densities present at the site. We collected detection data over all of them using the TEMTADS and attempted the use of both response amplitude and dipole filter target selection. Then collected Q data over approximately 1,200 detection data targets. The project used a QAP developed from the first draft of the GCMR template, and all of the detection and queued survey MQO started out as the requirements from worksheet 22 of that version of the template, which I think was late 2014. Like previous ESTCP demonstrations, all the queued targets were going to be dug using ESTCP intrusive methods, so whiteboard photos, GPS locations for all recovered sources, and the classification rank dig list would be compared to the ground truth from the intrusive investigation. Treatability study results would then be used to develop the use of classification as a potential remedial alternative in the FS. First step in this process was brush cutting the grids. All these, even the ones in the treeless fields, were nearly impossible to move through without 100% clearance. And that's still often left a bunch of trees and usually uncovered at least a couple of MEC items. We found 41 MEC items just on the surface during brush cutting for the RI and treatability study, extrapolated out for the entire site, that ended up being something like 1,200 plus MEC items on the surface. Treatability studying grids included a surface sweep, which wasn't done for the RI, and a total of 52 seed items were installed. 32 of those were QC seeds we could see before finalizing our rank dig list, and 20 were QA seeds that we did not know about before submitting the list. We started processing the dynamic TEMTADS data using both response amplitude and dipole filter. The data surrounding the dipole filter peaks were then inverted to develop polarizability curves and fit locations for potential sources. We ruled out the use of the inverted results pretty quickly, and just considered the dipole filter pick locations versus the response amplitude pick locations. The number of fit locations is significantly higher than the number of peaks identified by either one of the peak picking routines alone, and we couldn't find a filtering method that was successful in reducing the number of fits without eliminating picks on seed items. We probably could have done a bit more merging and eliminated some of the fits just based on the distance from the dipole filter peak. But one of the peak picking routines still seemed like it was going to be more successful even if we had. So looking at the anomaly counts up here for the peak picking options, TS Grid 4A is probably the best example of an ideal survey area at the site. Had no significant areas of really high anomaly density, and geologic response was fairly limited. T06 G15 here had a large trash pit in the middle, so we didn't consider those results particularly reliable for most of the site. And T07 G18 here was an example of the effects of geology on the dipole filter data. That is also the two pictures down here are both T06 G15 or T07 G18. Saipan's a volcanic island. We thought that there would be enough limestone overlying the volcanics that it wouldn't be much of a problem. That was true in some cases, like Grid 4A, but just not the case in others, like T07 G18, where the geology resulted in significantly more targets for the dipole filter than the response amplitude. So we ended up using the response amplitude for final dynamic target selections. The treatability study detection survey covered 3.4 acres. We picked targets using 1.45 millivolt per amp threshold on channel 5, which was five times the background measured in the IVS background survey. We also confirmed that that threshold would detect a horizontal 20 millimeter projectile at 15 centimeters depth, one half line spacing offset from the sensor. So following the detection survey, we ended up with approximately 2,900 targets, or almost 840 per acre. Those included targets over all of the QC and QA seeds. Finally, even using the response amplitude, which is shown in these two figures, there was still a notable difference in geologic response between grids. Grid 4A here and grid 4B were only about, at most, a couple hundred feet from each other, and grid 4B shows notably more geologic response. So that was a kind of an ongoing problem depending on where we were on the site. Treatability study was only funded for the collection of 1,200 cued targets, so the QC geophysicist selected a subset of the targets from the 2,900 detection targets by windowing groups that included that were near each other and included all of the seed items. Cued data collection went pretty much according to plan, and we classified the data using a classifier we've used on previous projects. That one ended up with a 37% dig rate, but misclassified a QA seed item. So we reclassified everything using what was then the new classify and rank process in UX Analyze. Depending on how much work you've done recently with UX Analyze, that may still be new. That was considerably more conservative than the first effort and resulted in a 45% dig rate before any intrusive investigation. But it did correctly classify the missed QAC item from the dig list as a TOI. Despite the more conservative classifier, the revised dig list still misclassified one QC seed item as non-TOI and exceeded the vertical offset MQO for another QC seed. Despite those failures, which I'll talk about later, the dig list was considered final prior to comparison to the intrusive investigation ground truth. After comparison to that ground truth, we determined that the predicted size, TOI, non-TOI threshold, and the non-TOI qualitative match MQOs were failed in addition to the problems with those two seed items. So I will get into why we failed those things. I'm going to complain about the geology at the site for the next couple of slides. But if you compare the TEMTADS results to the EM61 results in the same grid, so this is one of the overlapping grids where we had data from both, it looks like the TEMTADS is probably the best of a bad lot as far as DGM is concerned. two sets of response data at the top page show TEMTADS and EM61 results for grid T07G18. That was the same grid used for the response amplitude dipole filter comparison earlier. So these small red circles here in the TEMTADS dynamic data set show six locations where the TEMTADS identified small items that either weren't detected by the 61 or were in the middle of something that looks like geology. So this one up here and this one. Those detections agree with the IVS results, which showed significantly higher signal-to-noise ratio for the TEMTADS for the small ISO in the IVS line at 15 centimeters depth. So I think it's reasonably possible that the EM61 is potentially missing smaller items that are masked by geology in a lot of the EM61 data. The second set of data here at the bottom of the slide is an example of what the TEMTADS data leveling process removed. We used a rolling statistics filter for leveling, which is pretty standard, and it clearly removed a lot of geologic response, which is great if you're trying to select targets within a geologically noisy data set, but isn't particularly helpful if you're selecting queued background locations based on the level data on the left. So for this data on the left, that's the rolling statistics filter. For the data on the right, that is just a simple subtraction of what appeared to be the mean background for the entire grid rather than a long line. As shown, there's probably more geologic response under TS2AB1 here, our, one of our background points, than it appeared when we selected it as a background point. That becomes important because the background location was used to correct the data for the QA seed we misclassified on our first dig list. So this first set of polarizability curves up here shows the best library match for the seed data corrected using that background point I showed earlier. And we created those two maps as part of the RCA for that incorrect classification. So based on those maps and the fact that we thought our background point may actually not have been as backgroundy as originally thought, we recorrected the queued data for the seed using a background point in what appeared to be a less geologic responsive part of that same grid, and the library match results for the recorrected data are down here. They agree much more closely with a small ISO, which is what the seed was, than the top ones. Doesn't necessarily look like it by the library match statistic, but I mean, just looking at the curves, it looks a lot better in this one than it does in the first one. So despite knowing that one background point should have been used over the other, there's not a whole lot apparent in the individual decays for all of the receivers that one is significantly different than the other. The blue and green decays in this figure over here, which might be hard to see, are the two background points from the grid. This black decay here is the reference decay we used for the project. So basically, anything below that was considered acceptable for use as a background point as long as it passed all of the other background MQOs we had, which both of these points did. So just looking at these, the differences between the grid points and the threshold are a lot more apparent than any differences between the two grid points alone. As what we decided was there wasn't much reason to be concerned about that background point despite the fact that it ended up giving significantly different results for what appears to have been a cleaner background point. The misclassified QC seed was an inert 20 mil at 15 centimeters. It's pretty similar to the previous example, with the exception that there was no better background point. We collected two queued points on this target here, just because our GPS failed for the first one. Although the TEMTADS data was considered good, so it's both basically the same thing that we luckily reshot by accident. So these were over two different days with similar results. The primary curve looks okay, although it matches the secondary light. So this is the primary curve. The secondaries are all next to useless down here. So the primary curve looks okay, although it matches the secondary library curves better than the primary, which is more up here. It looks like the background correction just removed too much response for the secondary curves to model correctly. We did detect, correctly classify another 20 mil at 15 centimeters, but the RCA for this one determined that depth was about as deep as you're going to get for a 20 mil at the site, and it was kind of hit or miss at 15 centimeters. Our other QCC failure was a large ISO for which the model depth was 28 centimeters offset from the correct depth. Our MQO was 25 centimeters. However, that was a vertical ISO, so the top of the seed was only 13 centimeters offset from the model location. the RCA for that one concluded that the seed was unlikely to be missed despite the offset, and that's during the missed during the intrusive investigation. So between the seeds and actual mech recovered during the intrusive investigation, we found 78 targets of interest, and the sizes of 12 or 15% of those were predicted incorrectly. So we had small, medium, and large predictions. Small was basically 40 millimeters or smaller. Medium was bigger than 40, less than 105, and large was 105 and up. So the 15% incorrect wasn't a whole lot different from the failure rate we've seen on previous ESTCP projects that included TOI ranging in size from very small to very large, which we had at this site. So we found native 25s, we had 20 millimeters buried as seeds, and we were looking for everything up to like 8-inch naval rounds. So that's kind of the variation on this site. The incorrect predictions, the one thing different about this site was that the incorrect predictions on previous projects have mostly been too large. In this case, most of them were too small. So it appears to be another case of background correction removing too much response from the source data. A lot of these incorrect predictions were 60-millimeter mortars found in the same grid as the missed QA seed item, but recorrecting with alternate backgrounds didn't help in the case of the predicted size. So after comparing the intrusive ground truth to the dig list, we found two native TOI items. Neither of which was MEC. They were both TOI-like MD. They were classified as non-TOI on our ranked dig list. Both were 25-millimeter projectiles. The one at the top was a deformed lower-ordered item for which the decision metric was high enough to be TOI, but that was filtered out based on default size, decay and size thresholds set in the classify and rank process in UX Analyze. We revised the dig list to ignore these after the miss, and I think those have actually also been removed in the newer versions of UX Analyze. The other missed, so this is the 25 that came out of the hole with all this other stuff, that was also incorrectly classified. It looks from the polarizability curves for this target here, it looks like this bolt was probably what was actually modeled. In order to find that one, we had to revise the decision metric threshold on our dig list. So for validation targets, we were required to make a prediction about why something in the ground was not a TOI. And these are just two examples of non-TOI validation QC. This one was the lone failure for our predictions. I think we had 25. And this looks like a pretty straightforward incorrect prediction. We predicted too small, decays too quick, so it's probably big enough to have been a 20 or 25, just decays too quickly to actually be a solid piece of mech. The second down here was an asymmetric or plate-like prediction for these two pieces of rebar, which are obviously neither asymmetric nor plate-like. But we did pass this one with the assumption that the way they were positioned in the ground could have reasonably resulted in an asymmetric position. A lot of these validation predictions ended up being really subjective, so just something to look forward to on future projects. This is a short summary of the treatability study results. Basically, the dynamic survey appears to have been successful. It resulted in significantly higher anomaly rates than we saw in the EM61 data, but if you want to find small things at this site, that's probably a necessity. A Q survey was less effective. The first classify and rank dig list we submitted needed a couple of revisions to accurately classify native TOI, and the revised version has a 46.5% dig rate and still misses a QCC buried at what is now considered the approximate depth of detection for 20 millimeter projectiles at the site. There's no apparent solution to the incorrect size predictions if stakeholders consider that an important QC metric. And like I said on the last slide, just for future reference, passing or failing non-POI validation justifications is much less straightforward than anticipated. Here's the cost summary for the use of the – yep.
John, yeah, we're running out of time, so you'll need to wrap things up if you can.
Okay. So I'll jump to the conclusions. Basically, for the detection surveys, the TEMTADS can detect small items within the geologic noise at the site, probably better than the EM61, although using it is going to be much harder based on the cost of the instrument, slower productivity due to ergonomics and weight and maintenance concerns. For the cued survey, one TOI was missed, which was considered unavoidable. Past that, the TEMTADS investigation followed by a detailed intrusive investigation of just classified TOI actually ended up being more expensive than just taking all of the detection survey targets. So I can stop there if I'm out of time.
Okay, very good. It's good material, though. It's excellent. Yep, we just ran a little bit short on time. And moving on then to our next speakers. Our next speakers, we have Allison Paskey and Annie Gashow. And Allison, she's the lead geophysicist with NAVA. Andy is with Gilbane. And they're going to cover a case study for Fort Ord. So, Allison, Andy, it's yours. Allison, Andy, do we have you?
Yeah. Helps if I turn the mute off on my phone. So,
very good. We've all been there.
In this presentation, Allison and I wanted to give you a quick picture of how we were able to use advanced geophysical classification as a risk reduction tool prior to prescribed burn operations at Fort Ord. Advanced geophysical classification presentations with descriptions of the technology, images of polarizability curves and rock curves, summaries of project results and cost savings probably aren't new to most of you. So what Allison and I want to do is focus on the things that made this project a bit unique. It was designed, first of all, as a risk reduction activity rather than a full-scale mech removal. So our project goals were therefore different. We used different sensor settings, and we had a different target of interest list. So I'm going to start by giving you a quick summary of the project background and activities, and then I'll turn it over to Allison for the more interesting stuff, which is the lessons learned from using the metal mapper to meet the Army Corps' goals for this project. And my slides aren't moving. There we go. So the Fort Ord team consists of the Fort Ord BRAC office, the Sacramento District of the Corps of Engineers, our prime contractor, Chemron, Gilbane and NAVA Geophysics as sub to Chemron, and Acorn SI, who added third-party QC for this work. Additionally, we based a lot of our work on the ESTCP live site demonstration conducted late in 2014 and 2015 by CB&I and Black Tusk Geophysics. And I have CB&I to thank for this lovely picture from their demonstration project. So the former Fort Ord covers about 28,000 acres in Monterey County, California. In the southern part of the site, the impact area MRA, which you can see in kind of a darker pale yellow on this screen, is just over 6,500 acres. It's a portion of a historical impact area, and it's been designated as a habitat reserve. And the focus of this presentation and our risk reduction work will be on two units within the habitat reserve, units 11 and 12, that you can see in pink here. which lie close to the center of the impact area MRA and cover about 475 acres. One of the really unique things about Fort Ord is that we light things on fire on purpose. Due to its designation as a habitat reserve, the impact area MRA requires periodic burning to clear invasive vegetation species, as well as to encourage the regrowth of native vegetation. Prescribed burn operations can only be conducted between the months of July and December, but even then, the stars pretty much have to align perfectly, and we have to have all the proper meteorological conditions for the best vegetation consumption and good behavior of the smoke so it doesn't impact the surrounding areas. Generally, the right conditions occur no more than 5 or 6 times in any given year, sometimes not at all. And then we're also dependent on the availability of fire department support. So recent drought conditions and wildfire seasons in California have made it pretty tricky to conduct prescribed burns. So the point is that the moment we're given the green light to burn, we need to have all of our preparatory activities completed and be ready to drop the match. Units 11 and 12 were scheduled for burning several years ago in 2011. Sorry, let me get back to this other screen. But the burns were canceled when 155 millimeter projectiles were found on the ground surface during prep activities for the burn. To address the obvious hazard of lighting a fire in the presence of large mech items, the vegetation was cut so that surface mech removal could be done and DGM could be conducted. And the prescribed burn operations were rescheduled for 2015 when the vegetation had regrown enough to support burning. But the Army Corps Safety made the determination that mech items found on the ground surface in all likelihood means that the same mech items are probably hiding in the subsurface. And if those large mech items are shallow enough, they could present a risk to personnel managing burn operations around the perimeter of the areas being burned. So we were tasked with reducing the risk to burn personnel by removing large near-surface mech items, including 155 millimeter projectiles, 8-inch projectiles, and anything larger, to a depth of 2 feet below the ground surface in the outer portions of the burn areas, and that would reduce the risk on the fuel breaks surrounding each unit, and to a depth of 1 foot in the interior of the burn units, which would reduce the risk to helicopters flying overhead. Our plan to meet the risk reduction objective was to take the existing EM61 data, which had been processed to give the client a picture of the subsurface contamination, but never intrusively investigated. Then we would identify anomalies that met the amplitude criteria of our targets of interest at the appropriate depth, classify them through a cued metal mapper investigation to determine which could be left in the ground and which we needed to remove in order to more safely go ahead with the scheduled burn operations. Now, we had a pretty good idea that our risk reduction goal could be successfully met using the metal mapper based on the results of the ESTCP demonstration conducted by CB&I in portions of these very burn units a bit before our risk reduction project. Their primary objective was to determine if large mech items, such as 155 and 8-inch projectiles, could be correctly classified down to 2 feet in areas of high-density metallic clutter. They also had some secondary goals, including demonstrating if they could classify these same large mech items down to 4 feet, and if they could classify mech items of all sizes in this type of high-density area. CB&I, in their demonstration, correctly classified all of the large TOI in the demonstration areas, demonstrating that they could meet their primary objective of classifying the large mech items to 2 feet. And the first of their secondary objectives, which was the TOI to 4 feet, that was a little more difficult, but it was definitely doable. And when looking for all sizes of TOI, they correctly classified 97% of the mech items in the demonstration areas. So they were really close to that final secondary objective, but it wasn't quite possible with the high density of targets and metallic clutter. For us, though, their results were great news because they demonstrated that a cued metal mapper classification survey could easily meet the risk reduction goals the Corps had given us for getting units 11 and 12 ready for burning. So as I said before, we had a very high density of metal in the ground in these units. This DGM map shows the EM61 response in units 11 and 12. Anomaly densities ranged from about 1,200 an acre over in this area to over 3,500 an acre in this part of Unit 11. So even our low-density areas probably wouldn't really be considered low-density on most typical MMRP sites. So from the DGM data, we initially identified around 550,000 anomalies in these two units, and then we used a pretty straightforward discrimination technique based on the NRL response calculator for towed arrays to determine the minimum EM61 response amplitude for our smallest target of interest, the 155 projectile, at the maximum depths of concern. And this left us with 4,625 anomalies potentially related to our large TOI down to the risk reduction depth. On this map, you can see the inner and outer depth zones of the risk reduction area and the anomalies that we identified for acute investigation with the metal mapper. So in typical advanced geophysical classification style, we acquired cued metal mapper measurements over each target, converted and modeled the data, classified them against the signatures in our TOI library, and then ranked all of the targets according to their likelihood of being TOI and either dug or left them in the ground based on that ranking. And on to the results. We had to create our own classification library because we used the long 25 microsecond time gate on the metal mapper rather than the standard 8.3 microsecond time gate. This allowed us to focus on points later in the decay cycle where our large targets of interest still had strong responses, but the induced current in smaller non-TOI and clutter items had largely decayed away. Allison will talk a bit more about this in a few minutes, but we prepared our initial classification library by populating it with test pit signatures of targets of interest. And then we validated the library to determine if any TOI item signatures were not included by preliminary classifying the first 1,000 or so target measurements and selecting a set of targets for which we wanted immediate dig results. We identified 22 targets for calibration, including 6 to verify the dig-no-dig threshold, 13 from clusters of similar signatures that did not match any current library items, and 2 that had size and decay characteristics consistent with large munitions. So through this library validation process, we added signatures of 3 155-millimeter projectiles, and we also used the calibration dig results to create a non-TOI munitions library that were smaller munitions items that we didn't necessarily need to remove for this risk reduction activity. But we did give that information to the client just so they would have more information about hazardous items and their distributions. So I'm taking too much time here away from Allison's part, so I'm just going to breeze through this part. But suffice it to say that we used pretty conservative thresholds for classifying our targets of interest to add to the safety of the risk reduction as much as possible while still balancing efficiency with the time available for the project. Of the 4,625 anomalies we investigated with the metal mapper, we classified 589 as requiring intrusive investigation. That included our 22 analyst calibration digs and 567 that we decided needed to be dug up based on their classification matches. So that means that we were able to leave over 87% of the targets in the ground as high-confidence non-targets of interest. And we did find 2 8-inch projectiles, 235 155-millimeter projectiles, and the vast majority of everything we found were in our high-confidence TOI category, with just a few Category 2 digs resulting in TOI. And one additional thing is that 36 of the TOI we recovered were below those 1 and 2 foot risk reduction depths, giving us high confidence that we could easily classify and recover TOI at least to the depths required by the risk reduction objective. And then we did verification and validation investigations afterwards. No TOI were recovered from those validation investigations. Good news. We also wanted to show you a rock curve because you can't really do a presentation like this without one of these. You'll see this blue dot on there was our last target of interest recovered, and it was only about a third of the way through the number of targets that we dug. So we were pretty successful with those results. And at this point, I'm going to turn it over to Allison to get into the details of some of the things we did differently on this project and how we learned several good lessons that can be applied to future projects. Go ahead, Allison.
Okay, thank you, Andy.
At this particular site, the site conditions and our equipment configuration resulted in some unique situations that we hadn't encountered before. First up was the positioning accuracy using the IMU with the metal mapper. Areas of this site have very significant slope, and the EM61 array was used for the detection survey back in 2013, and it did not have any slope correction applied to account for the offset of the GPS location from the where the EM reading represented due to antenna tilt. During the cued metal mapper survey, it became apparent that the positioning of the EM61 targets was offset from the source locations in areas with higher slope, and frequently large offsets in a consistent direction with respect to the slope were encountered. The measurement quality objectives related to positioning for the project initially required us to have a measurement acquired with the center of the array within 16 inches from the flag or the selected target location. And due to the difference in the positioning corrections applied to the GPS locations between the detection and the cued surveys, we are finding that the initial cued metal mapper measurements near the flag location were frequently offset greater than 16 inches from the model source, which resulted in a large number of reshots to properly position the metal mapper above the source. The MQO was adjusted to allow for a larger offset from the flag location in areas where the IMU on the metal mapper recorded a higher combined pitch and roll value. And further support for this change to the MQO came later in the project after analysis of the classification results and some on-site testing demonstrated that it was possible to consistently model and classify correctly large shallow sources with a high confidence up to 80 centimeters away from the center of the array. With the large shallow TOI at this site and this result, we were comfortable going with a larger offset than the usually accepted 40 centimeter offset from the center of the array, and this increase in the distance from the metal mapper center for a model source was incorporated into our final classification and ranking expression for the project. The survey started out just using the metal mapper data acquisition software. Shortly after the beginning of the project, the in-field inversion software, BT Field, was provided to us by Black Test Geophysics, and we implemented the use of it within the first few days of this survey, and the benefits of using this were immediately apparent. The software assisted with navigation and refining the array position over the flag location, and it provided the field crew with immediate feedback on positional accuracy and an estimate of the source location. If the source was not identified within the MQOs for the project, they could immediately reposition the instrument to where it was indicated based on the inversion results. This greatly reduced the amount of recollection requests from the off-site data analyst. Intermittent high-magnitude single-point data spikes were observed in the raw data very early on in the project, and these were causing the modeling to fail. The spikes were observed in the initial days of data collection and could not be correlated with any external source. There are 63 transmitter-receiver combinations in each measurement, and the spikes, when they occurred, were limited to a single transmitter-receiver combination for the reading, and so the despiking of the data was not thought to significantly impact the quality of the measured data. We used a nonlinear filter, and the filter was set to remove only single-point spikes greater than 1,000 and interpolate a new value for that point. The red decay plot shown is a background-corrected data reading for a single transmitter-receiver combination. The blue decay plot in the middle shows the same data with the invalid point removed and the filtered data replacing it. The data was then modeled and produced the polarizability curve on the right, which show relatively low noise levels and also have a good fit coherence. Despiking of time domain EM data is common practice with the 61, but it had not previously been applied to the advanced sensor data. During this project, two different tow vehicles were used for data collection. The white Bobcat on the left started the project, and it was replaced with the larger yellow Cat vehicle on the right. The vehicles had different influence on the noise level of the data. This did not have a significant impact on the risk reduction survey due to the size and the response of the targets of interest. The increased noise was visible in the daily IBS surveys, and it is considered something that should be taken into account when planning future projects, specifically at Fort Ord, where other areas of the site, much smaller targets of interest, are of concern. It was determined if there is potential for small sources, one should be careful when selecting the vehicle to ensure that it has the lowest noise signature possible. As Andy mentioned, we used a long time range setting on the metal mapper for this. Part of the 2014 ESTCP demonstration that was done at Fort Ord compared the short, standard, and long time range settings for the metal mapper. The measured amplitude responses decay over time as the current induced and the target dissipates. The mass of the target affects the length of time at which the induced current can be detected and measured, with currents dissipating more quickly in thin-walled targets and remaining for a longer time in objects with more mass. The standard metal mapper surveys use an 8.3 time range for recording the measured EM response. The large TOI for the risk reduction activity allowed us to extend the measured time range to 25 milliseconds, providing the ability to start modeling the data at a later time, eliminating some of the response from the high density of small, non-target of interest clutter, while retaining the response from larger metallic items, including potential TOI with slow decay rate. A custom build of UX Analyze was provided by Acorn SI for this project to work with the long time range data.
Allison, we're running short on time, so yeah, we'll need to speed things up if we can.
Okay, well, as Andy mentioned, we did have to build a new library for this project due to using the longer time range. This started out with a fairly limited representation of items because our list of targets of interest were so short. We supplemented that by performing cluster analysis, and we added several additional targets of interest and several other non-target of interest munition items to the library that was used. There was not good communication about some of the culture features at the site that was provided to the data analysts, and the photograph here is a pretty good example of that. This target was initially considered to not have reliable parameters to classify it and was identified to be dug. After seeing the dig results, it was fairly clear that they had taken a reading directly over this large culture feature, and that should have been taken into consideration during the analysis. Another thing that we found was we did not have the detection data available to us during analysis, and this was to keep the seeding process blind from the analysts, so the QAQC seeds would remain blind. We thought that would have been useful. It was taken into consideration for final classification, but it would have been beneficial earlier in the process. Initial analysis of the cued data used a normalized goodness of fit evaluation, and this resulted in us missing a QA seed. And it was determined that the seed was not correctly classified because it was located in an area with very high metallic clutter and very high instrument response. Previous testing had shown that the first 15 time gates were likely to be saturated, and in these very high metallic clutter environments, we found that it was possible that up to the first 20 time gates could be saturated. We were able to correct for this by using the unnormalized goodness of fit measure, which was the chi-squared value. We set a threshold for that to identify measurements that were where the response was saturated and could not be confidently modeled. And those targets were added to the cannot analyze category, and including this allowed us to detect all of the seeds at the site. And with that, I'll pass it back to Andy for some quick concluding remarks.
So just as a quick summary, met the risk objection, the risk reduction goals by digging approximately 0.1% of the original 550,000 anomalies we saw in the EM61 data. That was less than 15% of the ones we investigated with the metal mapper. And in doing this, We were able to complete the risk reduction activity on schedule for these units to be ready for prescribed burn operations. And with that, I will close our presentation. Thanks.
Very good. Thanks, Allison. Thanks, Andy. Good info. Fort Ord, it's a great place. We need to move on to our next presentation. And this one is going to be brought to you by Matt Barner. Matt's with CH2M Hill, and he's going to be talking to us about Toby Hanna. Matt, we're getting a little bit of a late start, but I'll let you bleed into our intermission time just a bit. So the floor is yours.
Thank you, Dwayne. I'll try to make up some ground here. Thank you, everybody, for the opportunity to talk a little bit about some of the work that we've recently done at the Toby Hanna Army Depot. We did this work as part of an ESTCP live site demonstration. The objectives of the investigation were primarily to test the performance of an advanced EMI sensor in very challenging conditions, as you'll see in some of the subsequent slides. The work that we did consisted of two components, initial dynamic or detection survey, followed by cued interrogation of targets derived from the detection survey. The general site location, for those of you who are not familiar with it, it's the former Toby Hanna Army Depot is about a half an hour outside of Stroudsburg, Pennsylvania, near the Poconos. This slide shows a general depiction of the layout of the MRS in which we conducted the demonstration. There is a contractor that is performing munitions response actions at the site, so there was already an operational grid in place for us to use, which was very handy. This next slide here shows the layout of the demonstration area from within which our work was done. So the original demonstration area was approximately 11 acres, consisted of a series of grids. This area was specifically chosen within the MRS because to the west of the 11-acre area, there was a suspected impact area. That would be just to the west of the grids 78/48 on the slide. The installation has a long history. It's relatively old in terms of munitions use, as you can see on the slide. This was learning a little bit more about the installation through this work. I came to find out that this was a relatively significant site for the history of our military, in that it was the only site on the eastern seaboard, if I'm not mistaken, from around 1919 to 1930, where live cannon fire was used and was where it was permitted. So relatively significant, a lot of usage as a result. Munitions that have been recovered from the site, and these are as reported by a contractor who's doing work at the site, are primarily 75s and 155s. There is documented use of 37-millimeter projectiles at the former site. However, the use of those projectiles was reported in another area, not specifically within the MRS where we were working, and our classification results confirmed that there were no 37 millimeters identified. This slide here shows a couple of general photos from the MRS, gives you all a little bit of a flavor of what the site looks like in terms of the wooded conditions, very dense underbrush, variable terrain. For those of you familiar with the Poconos area or who have been to the site, you certainly know the challenges with the geology and the terrain, large boulders, large outcrops all over the place, impact craters as a result of the munitions use. And another challenge was the remote location of the site, particularly the MRS, was only accessible by UTV. I debated whether or not to show the photo of how we got the advanced EMI sensor down into the MRS, but I figured I'd spare my friends at NRL a sharp, searing pain behind the right eye by not showing that photo. But it was quite a challenge. It certainly posed a challenge in the investigation. The technology that we used the TEMTADS 2x2, various photos here of it. Due to the conditions, we put it into two-person gurney or litter mode. You might be asking yourself, Matt, why are there skis on it if you're in the woods? And the reason for that is we didn't have wheels available. I think John was using our wheels on some tropical island someplace. But nonetheless, we needed to put something on the bottom of the sensor to protect it. So when we needed to set it down, we weren't resting it on the actual clamshell that housed the sensor array. Photo in the lower left shows the IMU position. We used a Trimble robotic total station for positioning in the woods. The examples here are shown for the prism and the gun. The general approach was we originally conducted a magnetometer transect survey through the 11-acre area in order to identify 2 acres. Our goal was to identify 2 acres of grids. We wanted to try to find grids that had varying anomaly densities. Went through our regular site preparations, seeded the site with a bunch of ISOs. We had a land surveyor come in, obviously had to establish control, and then conducted the various survey activities, the dynamic survey, selection of targets, reacquisition and flagging of targets, and then the queued survey. And because this was a demonstration, all of the target locations were intrusively investigated, and that information was transmitted to the program office. We had an instrument verification strip set up on site. I didn't hear it mentioned before, but we conducted the IVS is used as part of the GSV process that we followed. Where, for those of you not familiar, we use it as a means to initially validate the sensor performance at the start of the investigation, and then use it for a series of quality control tests, both in terms of response and positioning throughout the investigation. The details of the IVS here are shown on the slide. This next slide shows a photo of the IVS with the various ISOs that we had. Three of the ISOs that we had emplaced in the IVS were oriented horizontally. One was vertically. Most of them were small ISO 80s. We had one medium ISO 40, and then a blank space. This slide shows some in-action shots of the dynamic survey. I've circled in red the location of the prism just as a frame of reference to show. We had to put it up pretty high because with, you know, not only do you have the challenges of the trees in the way, but you also have the two operators. You don't want them blocking a line of sight, as well as the tablet operator who is obviously not shown in these photos here. It took us about 8 days to collect 4 grids worth of data. And at the end of it, I mentioned earlier we had tried to get about 2 acres identified, but we were only able to get about 1 acre collected. Part of that was a big schedule driver. We started this work last summer in July, and for those of you from Pennsylvania or familiar with Pennsylvania, there's a major state holiday that starts at the beginning of September, and that is the start of hunting season. So we had to get out of the site, finish up all operations, including all intrusive work. So we only were able to get about 1 acre of data. And then what we had done was, because this was a demonstration, we wanted to assess what the additional effort would have been to actually get 100% coverage in one of the grids in which we mapped. As you'll see in some of the results here, we certainly struggled with that as a result of line of sight issues. And we decided to take one of the grids of the four and try to quantify what that extra level of effort was, and it took us about 3 days. As I mentioned, we did 4 grids. There were two side-by-side grid pairs. This grid here on the left shows the results from the western grid pair. Clearly, you can see there's gaps as represented by the white space and the coverage. These are largely due to the result of the trees and line of sight. The red squares represent the control points that the surveyor had placed and in an attempt to give us as much line of sight access and ability to move our total station around to capture as much of the area as we could. The next slide shows the east grid pair. This shows the coverage that we were able to achieve initially, and I want you to sort of train your eyes on the left grid of this pair, because the next slide shows what we were able to do as a result of getting the additional coverage in this grid. We still have some gaps. These are due to trees or genuine inaccessible features within the grid, but we were able to actually get 100% coverage in this one grid. We didn't have time to get it to do that in the rest of the grids due to our schedule constraint. This slide shows the target selections from the east grid. The dynamic results here are shown with a 2.3 millivolt per amp cutoff for the threshold, and we used the 0.137 millisecond time gate. We came back after we got all the drive target locations. We came back and did the queued interrogation with the TEMTADs on our skis in gurney mode. This photo kind of sets the stage a little bit for some of the issues that we ended up having. You know, as I mentioned, we had to have the prism up pretty high in the air to avoid the gun getting in the way of the gun. But in hindsight, we probably could have reduced that a little bit, because if you can imagine sort of a straight line coming out of the center of the TEMTADs array, you see that the pole sort of deviates a little bit from vertical under its own weight. And even though we made that as rigid as we could with Garolite and fiberglass, over time it just started to wobble a little bit. And this was most significant in the dynamic survey, as you'll see from some of the results. We got about 62 targets a day is what it took us in this mode between the two grid pairs. And that was with the surveyor flagging the targets in advance. We didn't do any sort of real-time navigation to them. This slide is meant to present the function test results throughout both the dynamic and the queued survey. This demonstrates that, well, quite simply, the TEMTADs was functioning throughout the data collection effort, which is always good news. Now into a little bit of the results. The IVS survey performance, as you can see, we had some trouble. We had some trouble with not meeting the metric on the positioning, and this was largely due to that wobble in the prism. Even though the IVS was built in a relatively flat spot, pretty close to the gun, not really any obstructions. It's just the simple motion of the array and the gurney and the operators walking and bouncing caused enough of that sway that it created some issues there with the positioning. As you see in the results presented as an average, we don't really have any better precision than we do accuracy during this dynamic IVS survey. In the queued survey, things change a little bit because obviously we're stationary. As shown in that photo, we still had a little bit of lean on the prism, which created some issues when you compared the positioning results to the ground truth. But when you compare the average, things tighten up a lot better, which is good, which is what we would certainly expect. The bottom image on this slide shows the beta amplitudes. ISO 3 was our medium ISO. The seed performance, we also struggled a little bit with in dynamic mode. The good news is that we detected all of the seeds. The issue, though, that we had, as you saw in some of those data coverage maps, was that in some instances we may not have fully gone over the seed item due to where it was located relative to a tree or due to some issue with the refresh rate of the RTS as you're moving along. So we had some failures on the dynamic survey in meeting that the tolerance within our 40 centimeter halo. The good news is that all of the seeds were added to to dig categories on the dig list. So in the end, we would have recovered all of the seed items through the intrusive, but clearly had some issues on the positioning with the dynamic survey. These slides summarize our results against our MQOs. This slide here primarily shows the dynamic survey results. And while it might not look good to see all those words fail in that last column, with a little bit of context, it's certainly explainable. We had primarily, again, due to the line of sight issues, the data gaps, and the movement of that prism. Not only do we have the data gaps that are associated with the trees themselves, as you're moving along with the TEMTADs, if the prism loses sight, there's a period of refresh rate that occurs once it reestablishes lock. Well, the operator, although they're carrying the Trimble data collector and they know that, it's just impossible to stop and start that much. So there's going to be some issue associated with that. There's also at times when the RTS would totally lose the prism, so you would have to stop and somebody would have to go manually reset it. So a lot of those issues, a lot of these failures here come as a result of the data gaps, of the line of sight issues, and then of course our wobble on our prism. But this is what the demonstrations are for. We found this to be very good information, very useful information. And then when we move to the queued interrogation, or we move to the queued survey, we find that we perform much better. And the main takeaway from all of this is that in these challenging conditions, with the TEMTADs in this particular mode using this particular positioning system, there are certainly challenges with the dynamic survey. And meeting some of these maybe stringent MQOs that you might apply to a survey under different conditions. However, the classification still works. We are still able to actually classify properly here, and this is our preliminary rock curve. As Andy said earlier, we can't have one of these talks without a rock curve, and we think that we're very pleased with this rock curve. We didn't have to hunt around a lot. To get all of the TOI, so we're very pleased overall with the effort. the lessons learned through all of this, I've touched on many of them already. Primarily, again, just due to the site conditions, it was very, very challenging. We certainly had a lot of challenges with the positioning. We tried to plan it, as best we could. We had the surveyor. We were out there with the surveyor to establish the best line of sight for the control points to try to optimize our line of sight throughout the entire grids. But as you saw in the photos, there's a lot of trees, a lot of variables at play here. There's also just the general fatigue of carrying it. That sensor in that array is pretty heavy. I was talking with one of our health and safety folks afterwards, and he asked me if I'd done my stretching beforehand, and I said, well, it wasn't really necessary because at the end of it, my arms were already on the ground. They were already stretched out pretty far, but he didn't find that too funny. At any rate, the survey we think was a success. The detection survey, despite the challenges, certainly works. It certainly can be done, and classification was still successful at the end. Of course, I would like to thank our friends at NRL for use of the TEMTAD system and for continued support, as well as support from the program office throughout this investigation. And Duane, that's all I've got.
Well, Matt, that's awesome. But I have to tell you that now I will forever have an image in my head of our geophysicists as knuckle draggers, where they've been carrying the equipment. That is so awesome.
Yeah, no, I sort of lofted that one up there, for you. But it was challenging.
Very good, very good. I'll tell you what, we have just a minute before our scheduled intermission, and I'm going to go off script here just a bit. And I'll throw this out here. This question came in really during the Markey Point presentation, But I'll throw it out there to any of y'all who presented the case study material. And that was, the Marpy Point, it talked about the geological interference, the features there, and the volcanic issues. But is background, is that a significant issue for sedimentary rocks? Y'all seen that?
Since it came up on mine, I guess I'll answer. No, for the most part, it's mostly been volcanics. It was a little more difficult at I'm spacing on where we were. Camp Deal in California. There was some difficult geology that I don't think was volcanic, but for the most part, it's been problems with volcanics.
Got it. Okay, very good. All right, well, like I said, I thought I would just throw that out there since we had a minute or two, but we are at our intermission time now, so I'd like for everybody to stretch, go get some tea, coffee, or whatever. We are going to pick back up at 5 after the hour crisply, and we have one more presentation that we're going to cover, talking about accreditation update of where we're at with the DACAP, and then we're going to launch into our subject matter expert panel discussion. So please be sure to join us at 5 after the hour. Thanks.
Okay, Dwayne, it looks like we've come to the end of our scheduled intermission time. Are you carry on with the presentation?
Yes, I believe we are ready to resume. So our next speaker is Mr. Kevin Coates. And Kevin's with the Corps of Engineers of the Environmental and Munitions Center of Expertise, where he's the chief of the Environmental Sciences Division. And he's also the Army's rep on the DOD's Environmental Data Quality Work Group. And so in that capacity, he's been working on accreditation for advanced geophysical classification. So, Kevin, can you give us the latest scoop on DAGCAP?
I will certainly do that. Good afternoon, everybody. And just to amplify what Dwayne just said, I'm certainly not working by myself on this, and we'll kind of fill in the team as we go through here who's been working on the accreditation. So in a very quick 20 minutes here, we're going to go over the DOD Advanced Geophysical Classification Accreditation Program and an overview, and define the major program elements, and take a look at what the road ahead is, and then I guess right from here we're going into the questions and panel, I think, for the entire session today. So as very much context to the accreditation, there is a two-part quality system strategy that's been created to serve advanced geophysical classification, and it consists of a GCMR QAP, which has, as of April, been signed by DOD and is currently with EPA for signature. And the reason it's with that interagency group is because the IDQTF is comprised of EPA, DOD, and DOE, although not an active participant in this. So we're very close on that piece of the quality system. And then the other is the accreditation program, which is going to be the talk today. The why use accreditation rationale, pretty much self-evident, hopefully, but pieces that are most compelling to me is that it provides for ongoing and repetitive reevaluations of a geophysical classification organization's capability, and serves for monitoring quality system in the spirit of continued compliance. And it also has elements of self-realized corrective action, prevents repetitive noncompliance for the same themes or same issues that would have come up, and establishes a framework for continuous improvement organizationally, and that serves the program and the sites that we're cleaning up. And certainly not last is this red text here, that it enhances confidence by the clients, regulators, and public. And I think you heard a comment from Fred Dreeman in the first presentation on how the regulators, I think, rely upon these quality elements to have confidence in leaving metal at these sites. So an overview, we are actually copying, by creating DAGCAP, a lab accreditation program that is implemented by the Environmental Data Quality Work Group. And its basic elements are that it uses third-party accreditation bodies to conduct these assessments. And for this particular program, we use a standard, which is called the Quality Systems Requirements. And that will be what organizations will be accredited to, that standard. And I'll cover what's in there in a little bit. It applies to all testing organizations, regardless of size or volume of business. And it applies to use of HEC on all MRFs. And I'll talk here just real quick about the policy that goes along with this. So that's where the idea and the genesis of this part of the quality system came from. As far as tracking through where we've been and where we are right now, as of mid-April 2016, there was a subgroup within EDQW established in the fall of 2015. I'm the lead for that subgroup that's creating putting together the doctrine and the implementation policy for this, but there's a multi-partite membership to it that I'll show you in a second here. We established, or we had a DoD policy memo issued in May 2015 that established the program. The QSR document itself, the standard, was finished in December of 2015. Earlier in 2015, we began the development of a demonstration site at Aberdeen Proving Ground, which is ongoing, and I'll tell you the specific status of that. We, during last July to September, selected two accrediting bodies that will evaluate organizations who want to become accredited. We had some very good training in December of 2015 that NAOC was the sponsor for, that went over the ISO 17025 standard itself and the QSR, and I think we had upwards to 60 or 70 people at that, so it was very well attended. And very important, just hot off the presses, on April 11th, 2016, there was a policy memo that we've been waiting for, was signed at the DoD level that implements DAGCAP. It's a very short memo, one page. It gives very brief background on the technology and then the definition of DAGCAP, and then it presents some timing policy, and I'm going to read here. It's only two sentences. It says, organizations may begin the DAGCAP accreditation process in the second quarter of calendar year 2016, which is now passed. The DoD component shall begin using accredited organizations on their MRSs beginning in calendar year 2017. So there will be some contractual language going along with this and the various component organizations' contracts that will ask for this accreditation. And the policy memo, along with being attached to a memo from DoD, also contained a three-page list of frequently asked questions that kind of allow the one-page memo to stand without a lot of extra verbiage. And also there was a electronic version of the QSR itself. So that material will soon be posted on the EDQW page on Denix, and it eventually will migrate to a munitions subpage, a military munitions subpage. But for right now, all the things related to this that are for public consumption are going to be posted on the Denix EDQW page. As far as organizational support by DoD for DAGCAP, it's a chartered activity within EDQW. It has terms and conditions that are used to recognize and to guide the accrediting bodies. It, as I said, the membership includes a member from each component service and a research geophysicist and some quality systems specialists, and I am the chair of that subgroup. And we will implement various aspects of the program, and I'll go through that list in a short bit. And we also have funding commitment for 5 years to oversee and implement the program within the various interests within DoD. The responsibilities of this group are creating doctrine that relates to the program, and the QSR would be the primary thing that we've got so far. There will also be some SOPs, which are mostly for our own internal administration of the program. There's one SOP on the complaints process that there may be. We've done this for ELAP, and we've publish that, and that will be out on the Denix website at some point. We've already participated in the AB selection. We've got two ABs, as I said, who are going to accredit for this program, and we've had training for them and taken them out to a site where the technology is actively shown. There will be, once there are assessments ongoing, there will be observation by government geophysicists for those operations out at Aberdeen. There is a couple other administrative things that go along with this, just like we do with ELAP. I won't spend any time on those. But ultimately, when a geophysical classification organization has become accredited, it will be posted on Denix, just like we do for ELAP, and the ABs will also have a listing on their web page that goes along with that, and that scope of accreditation will be shown and available there. Okay, now we're going to move into the standard against which these organizations will be accredited. It's based on an international standards organization, ISO 17025 standard, and it has some more general terms that are used, but by the time we were developing the final version of the quality systems requirements, we'd arrived at a conclusion that we ought to give something that's familiar to this technology and these organizations. So we've, instead of accrediting labs or a crazy term like conformity assessment body, we're using the term geophysical classification organizations, and that will be appear in the documentation for the program. It's the ISO document itself has two major components, which are quality standards that relate to management and technical standards. The QSR document itself is a overlay of the ISO 17025 standard that presents specific requirements that are beyond the ISO 17025 that relate specifically to what DOD wants in this technology application and the quality system. And it's expressed in some multicolored text, if you've seen it. There are clarification items, requirements items, and guidance items. And I think they're blue, green, and black, and I don't remember which is what color, but when you pick it up, all the definitions that go along with that way of organizing it are right up front, so it makes it fairly easy to use. The quality standard that's expressed in ISO 17025 has some particular elements that are apply to anything that ISO 17025 is used for, and I won't read this, but some very essential ones in my mind are the qualifications, training, experience of staff, the requirements that go along with that, such that they're auditable by the accrediting bodies, the management accountability with regard to implementing the technology by the organization, measurement traceability, and external assessments, and certainly the DACAP be one of the external assessments that go along with the organizations doing this. Now we move to the accrediting body, these third-party accrediting bodies, the responsibilities that they have in executing the program. There's three primary steps that go along with them doing this. There'll be some documents that will be provided from the GCOs going through the process prior to any site visits, and that will be done in a desk audit fashion by the accrediting body, SOPs and qualification, personnel qualification, training records, those sorts of things probably. And then there will actually be an on-site assessment by the AB, probably in the office or a centrally agreed-upon location where records are available and personnel can be interviewed that go along with the quality system implementation, and there will be auditable findings that can come out of that And then finally, there'll be this demonstration of capability at the Aberdeen Proving Ground site, and I'll go through that in pretty good detail here in a minute. So the accrediting body will, from that three-part process, prepare a final assessment report that will include a listing of nonconformances, which will have to be responded to by the GCO, and an acceptance of that nonconformance corrective action will have to be documented before accreditation can be granted. The ABs will reassess because, you know, the requirement will be for these organizations to be accredited at any point when they're working for the government under contract doing advanced classification on one of our MRSs. And there may be some interim type surveillance things that the ABs will want to ask for or view in terms of the GCO's quality system as that term of validation progresses. There, as with anything, with granting accreditation, there can also be a suspension or withdrawal of accreditation for, there's in the quality systems requirement, there's some inappropriate practices listed that have to do with various things, but, you know, data inappropriate data manipulation or anything like that would possibly be grounds for that. And then, as I said, when the accreditation is complete, it'll be posted by DOD on the DENIX website. The accreditation of the GCOs will have these elements, and it is a single field of accreditation. This is distinctly different from what we do for labs. And I've missed one of the parts of it on this slide, so I'll just read it off here. The single field of accreditation will be termed a testing category of subsurface munitions, a technology as electromagnetic induction, and a method as advanced geophysical classification. That will be the single field. And by granting accreditation, it attests to the capability of the GCO in meeting the minimum requirements expressed in the QSR, and talked about, or back to my initial note that there's a quality assurance project plan template. So each one of these projects will have a site-specific QAP that goes along with it, and in terms of the accreditation versus the QAP, there can be additional technical requirements in the QAP, and the quality system will just make sure that the QAP requirements can be understood and implemented by the GCO on a particular project, that they're paying attention to those things and they're, of course, communicating with the customer about them. The accreditation is renewed every 2 years, and there may be some things that go on within that two-year time frame that might be specific to how the AB and the GCO want to handle things. So now on to the Aberdeen demo site. Basically, it was a former ESTCP site that we've completely reconfigured. We've removed everything that was there and reseeded it. And in terms of the demonstration, the GCO has to bring all the hardware, software, and any staff that's going to be proving out on their SOPs. There'll be an indoor area provided for data analysis. As they, maybe just prior or as they're getting to the site, there'll be a conceptual site model description that will describe what this would be in terms of an actual implementation on a MRS working for DOD. So just a few constraints with regard to the site itself. All the scoring of the submittal, the product by the GCO at the end of the demo is going to be scored by our APG staff out there. And the accrediting body will have somebody present on site during the entire demonstration, which is estimated to be 5 days, with a little cooperation of the weather. And the ultimate test site configuration is 5 acres that's been seeded, and ultimately that'll leave multiple half-acre sites so that we can have multiple GCOs and even the same GCO out there more than once without repeating the same area. So as I said, 1 week for on-site demonstration completion. All data is collected and analyzed and performed while they're at the site, on-site. The contractor will have, or the GCO will have access to a calibration and IVS instrument check area. They will do a dynamic survey to select anomalies, cue those anomalies that they think are worthy of that cued survey, and then the ultimate product at the end of that week is a ranked anomaly list, which is with a stop dig threshold identified, which will be scored by the APG staff. So the road ahead, fairly simply, now that we've got our policy memo in place, is to have in the component services will begin, and I'm sure this will be addressed in the questions coming up, but contractual requirements for MRS that they're implementing advanced geophysical classification on for the use of accredited GCOs, and that in terms of timing has to be in place by the end of calendar year 2016, and the policy memo said beginning calendar year 2017. And then as far as kind of a general road ahead milestone, we're going to continue to train in a variety of manners for different stakeholders. And there's actually the Munitions Response Dialogue Group within DOD has a training matrix that we're working off of. And I don't have all the details, but there is anticipated the need for quite a bit of training for various stakeholders. And then my EDQW group will oversee and coordinate, collaborate as we go through here. And like I said, we have funding for this for 5 years, and then as that time moves on, I'm sure we'll get ahead of the next phase to make sure we're able to continue and oversee. So when I did this slide, I guess I didn't quite have a full view of the panelists. I think we've also got, and this isn't necessarily specifically part of this presentation, but we've also got, I think, Brian Jordan and Andy Schwartz will be joining us for the panel. So that's all I have, Duane.
Excellent. Very good, Kevin. And yes, that's a perfect segue into our next portion of the web. And we're going to try to do a panel discussion today of the subject matter experts. And so, you know, the first thing I wanted to do was introduce our panel, make sure that we've got them on board. And so Kevin Coates is one of our panelists, and you heard me introduce Kevin. He's with the EMCX. He's Army's rep for the DOD's EDQW. So Kevin, you're still with us, right?
Hey, I went on mute because that was what I thought I was supposed to. Yes, I'm still here.
Okay, very good. And then, you know, we have Herb Nelson. Herb has been a frequent contributor to our M2S2 webinars in the past, and is a terrific speaker. Herb, he's the program manager for the munitions response at CERTIP and ESTCP, and so if there's anybody that I would consider to be the godfather of advanced classification, it would probably be Herb. So, Herb, do we have you?
I'm here.
Excellent. Good. And then we also have Jordan Adelson, and Jordan, he's the director of the Navy's Laboratory Quality and Accreditation Office, and he also serves as the chair of DOD's EDQW, the Environmental Data Quality Work Group, and so he has been working very heavily with the DAGCAP and the accreditation processes. So, Jordan, are you on board?
Yes, I'm on the line.
Very good. And we have Andy Schwartz. Andy, he's a senior geophysicist at the Corps' EMCX, and he's worked on munitions projects for a number of years. And Andy is really kind of, he's spearheading the Corps of Engineers, the technology transfer, the transition to production of DOD's Advanced Geophysical Classification Initiative. So, Andy, are you out there?
Yes, I am.
Very good. And then we also have Brian Jordan. Brian is with the Range Support Center. He's been involved with a number of the demo projects. Brian is a chemist and is also very knowledgeable about data quality, both from the chemistry and from the geophysics. So, Brian, are you on board?
I am out here.
Very good. Okay, well, the way this is going to kind of work then, we've sent out an advanced solicitation to all of the registrants for the webinar, for today's webinar, asking for questions that they would want to ask this panel regarding advanced geophysical classification. And so I've assembled those questions. I've tried to organize them. But in addition to that, and we'll be working through those, but in addition to that, you can continue to submit questions through the Q&A panel. If we have time or I see a particularly timely or insightful question, then we'll also work that into the session. And this is kind of a new thing, so I hope that we don't have any technical issues with it, but we're going to give it a go, and I will be moving the questions here into our display frame and then reading them for everybody and asking our panel to comment on them. So we're going to start with a pretty easy one. And this one, you know, it's, are there other references? Are there other resources to learn more about advanced geophysical classification? And I'll throw this out to all of the panel, but I guess I'll kind of start with Herb because, Herb, I kind of feel like your organization is the wellspring of knowledge for advanced geophysical classification.
Well, thank you, Dwayne. I actually would think that the archived M2S2 webinars on geophysical classification over the last 2 or 3 years and the ITRC training that's recently been archived would be the two best places to get started for a new person trying to learn about geophysical classification. Of course, one can always go to the CERTIP and ESDCP website, which, of course, I don't know what it is, and I should. It is CERTIP-ESTCP.org, and on that, from that site, you type in search for geophysical classification, you can find a lot of information.
Okay, that's good. Does anybody else on the panel, do I have other resources that you would like to tell everybody about?
This is Andy. I also believe there are some talks that have been given at recent conferences that would make good places to get some information. The Symposium of Applied Geophysics to Environmental and Engineering Problems, this year and last year, I believe, had a number of talks on the topic, and probably previous years as well. And when we used to have that thing called the UXO Forum and the M2S2 stand down, there were some good information provided there as well. So in past talks, going pretty far back, you can bring yourself up to speed with how we got to where we are today.
Okay. Anybody else have any references they would like to share?
Dwayne, this is Jordan. The one thing I'd like to add as well is that we've got actually some upcoming training on the Advanced Geophysical Classification QAP template that Kevin mentioned in his two-phase approach for quality. With the implementation of this technology. And so those will be done through CERTIP ESTCP's website, and they'll be broken into two offerings. The first will be May 19th, and the second will be June 16th. Those will both be recorded and archived, and those I think will be useful resources for folks.
Okay. Excellent. Good stuff. All right. Well, I'll tell you what. Did somebody else have someone they wanted to add?
This is only deserved to say I sent the link to that to Gene, so maybe we can get that by the end of the time.
Oh, okay, that's a great idea. Thanks, Herb. All right, well, I'll tell you what, we'll look at our next question here, and this one's a little bit wordy, a little bit long, but it's several of the ITRC technical fact sheets, they mentioned comparison of EMI responses to the unknown item in the target of interest library of the known munition responses. There's been various status updates to the development of the library that have been provided by the DoD representatives, You know, what is the current status of the TOI library and its availability for contractors to utilize? And so I think I'll throw this to the librarian. Andy, what's up with the TOI library?
I knew that was coming to me, Duane. Thank you. And I should be more prepared for this than I am as the librarian. I'm going to punt this to Herb in just a second because he will be able to tell us a little more about the ongoing work that is going to comprise the final library. What we are doing is we are ramping up to bring it into our office to begin the management and dissemination aspects of it. We are still at the early stages, mostly because this wasn't on my radar until this question came up. But we'll be working pretty hard on it and feverishly on it over the next couple of months to make sure it's ready for everyone during the accreditation process. Herb, do you want to give us an update on where we are with the actual data that's going to make this thing up?
Absolutely. So I am holding the library in my hand as we're giving this presentation. It's on a nice little 64-gigabyte thumb drive, which I am fortunate in NRL to be able to use, but Andy can't. So, Andy, I guess I will have to send it to you through Amerdeck. Let me add a couple of comments, though. So we have intentionally structured this library that it is not dependent on any software product. We don't want to be locking people into using a product just because the library is for that. So these are library data, which each of the individual software products, for example, UX Analyze, will have to import. And I've been communicating with Dean Kieswetter about UX Analyze, and they're working on making sure they can read these files. So step one would be to obtain this library and then import it into whatever software package you're using. That step is still in progress. But the library is complete and in my hand.
Okay, very good. All right, well, sound like that's moving along then. Let me get to our next question. And that's, will DADCAP accreditation, will that be required only for Corps of Engineers contracts? Or for all of the services? And Jordan, I'll ask you that one.
It'll be required for all of the services.
Okay, so all of the services are going to be covered by DADCAP.
Yeah, the memo that Kevin cited was a DOD memo requiring it for the Department of Defense. So it wasn't specific just to the Corps, even though they have the lion's share of the projects that will be utilizing the technology.
Okay. Pretty good. Okay, would the panel please comment on whether the state of development and acceptance of advanced classification methods are compatible with performance-based fixed-price contracts, which are increasingly used for our RI and RA work? Andy, I think you probably got a pretty good handle on where we stand with that.
Sure do. So absolutely, or they are completely compatible. Really what we're talking about is another tool that we have in our toolbox, whether it's for the characterization RI or for the remedial action. And this tool simply provides similar or better data, both in terms of quality and quantity, than the other tools we currently have in our toolbox.
Okay. Good. All right, for our next question, will advanced geophysical classification equipment availability be a bottleneck? I've heard of Metal Mapper 2.0. You know, it's a newer, more ruggedized version being developed. When will it be commercially available? You know, what about commercial availability of the other AGC platforms? And I guess, Herb, do you have a handle on this? Do you have any insight on it?
Well, I have some insight, but it's been wrong so many times. It's like picking political stuff this year, you know, you wish you hadn't picked. So they are certainly, this is geometrics now, the manufacturer's equipment, certainly developing the Metal Mapper 2.0, but they've made it clear that until they have the commercial version of the TEMTAS, the smaller thing that several of the speakers today spoke about, out and being sold, that they're going to hold up Metal Mapper 2.0. The last I heard from Geometrics, the commercial TEMTAS was supposed to be available this month, April. I look down at my computer and see it's April 21st, so we're getting pretty running out of this month. I think if Dwayne hadn't asked me this so quick, I would have gone to the Geometrics website to see what it say, but what it says. But I think that would be the safest thing, is to check with Geometrics on the exact availability.
I gotcha. Andy or Brian, have you all heard any gossip, any scoop?
No scoop, pretty much what Herb said, but I do know I have been pinged by some people about availability in rental pools. So there are some, at least one that I'm aware of, a rental entity out there that is looking very hard at buying one of the first runs and making it available for rent. And as for the other tools, the MPV, I am told, can be made available. I don't know precisely how or through what mechanism, but I will be looking into that a little more to help answer this question.
Yeah, so Andy, that's a good point. Obviously, the TEMTADs that NRL has are being made available because several of the talks today employed them.
Yeah. Correct.
I will mention that the Army Corps' original four that have been made available for some projects, actually on many of the demonstrations, is government-furnished property. We heard in the last webinar two of them are coming to the end of their lifespan and are going to be retired to the museum, as we heard Travis explain to us. That leaves the two that we do have. I don't know what the status is of those. I suspect that if they are operable, they would be available for government furnished property. I know that the Army Corps is looking into buying some of the new units, but I don't know the timeline, and the likelihood that they'd be made for available is not very high. Our primary purpose will be for our internal uses during the verification and validation. Sorry, I always get these two confused.
Me too.
The validation seeding phase to make sure that what we put in the ground can actually be detected and inverted properly.
So I'm okay. On the Geometrics website. There's a data sheet on what they call the new metal mapper 2x2 for UXO surveys. It says pretty much what I said, and it tells you to contact emsales@geometrics.com.
All right. Well, yeah, I'll be going down to their showroom here as soon as we finish up with the webinar. Checking that out.
Man, I'm sure they're making show specials today.
Bring your checkbook.
Very good.
In California, bring your pink slip.
Very good. Thanks, guys. Good stuff. Gene, what happened to our font? It's displaying a little funky. Can you fix that?
No, I can fix that for you right now.
Excellent. Good. All right. This question was, you know, when will DoD require companies to be accredited? You know, is there a grace period? You know, in the meantime, should they show that they are attempting to get accredited? And so I'll ask Kevin and Jordan, what are your thoughts on this?
Well, Jordan can amplify, but the policy memo stated what I guess will then be translated into the contracts, but the end of calendar year 2016, beginning of calendar year 2017 is when that needs to be accomplished to support projects or MRS activities where AGC is being used. There is no grace period. You know, you can't become half accredited. And it really isn't any purpose served by I don't know how we'd ask it or show it anyway, but that there's an attempt to get accredited. DoD, because we'll be observing the accreditation activities by the ABs, we'll kind of know who's along the way. But I think in terms of projects and the contracting entities within the component services, I don't think that'll be of great interest in. I suppose if they're getting right up on a contract being led and it looks like the accreditation is tracking right up to that, I suppose that could be a point. But I think that's just somebody writes somebody an email and says we're almost done, but you still have to prove it by a credential.
Partial credit, huh?
Now, just to echo what Kevin said, you know, and Duane, yeah, what you said is correct. There is no partial credit. You're either accredited or you're not. And so the program requires you to be accredited to do this work for us, and it has a pretty specific deadline. And I think that should address the answer to the question.
Okay. There was a reference in Kevin's material to a DACAT manual and SOPs being developed by EDQW. Do y'all know when are those going to be available? You know, are they oriented toward the DOD users of AGC or to the contractors? And so, again, I guess I'll throw this back to Jordan and Kevin.
Jordan, take it.
Sure. At the EDQW, we like to follow our own processes and have defined processes for how we're going to operate. And these SOPs are designed to do that, to sort of document how we are going to implement the program. And so Kevin, in his talk, mentioned an example of an SOP is the complaint process, and it outlines how that goes forward and how anyone in the process or anyone along the way can go through complaining or raising concerns. There will also be an SOP that covers that we actually followed. It was in draft format, but for recognition of the accreditation bodies, an SOP for how we update the QSR document. And so these SOPs are intended for how the program will operate. They're not really for external, but they provide us a structured format for how we maintain the program and how things exist. And that's the purpose and point of the manual and the SOPs.
I see. Okay. Good. Okay. This next question, I'm gonna send this Andy's way. But you know, there was a lot of discussion in the technical community about, you know, potential cost effectiveness of using AGC at sites. Is there any realistic cost comparison information for the use of advanced classification versus the more traditional geophysical methods for anomaly identification and investigation?
Yes, there is. We have, that I'm aware of, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 sites, maybe even 6, where the technology has been used for a real remedial action, where the project managers have reported back to us using their project numbers when they initially went to do their work with traditional DGM and then ended up moving to this or using this technology to begin with. So, and realizing cost savings ranging from about 40 to 60%. So we do have real data. These numbers mimic very closely the numbers that we have seen in the ESTCP demonstrations as well. So we have good reason that we can use the 26 or 24 plus demonstrations cost analyses that have been done as well and fit into our cost models.
Okay, very good. Okay, here, you know, if a Corps of Engineers district, as a Corps district, what is it that I need to know to put in my PWSs to facilitate advanced geophysical classification? You know, when do I need to start doing that? You know, is it premature to start doing it now? And, you know, who can I turn to for assistance? Andy, you and Brian, you probably are closer to this than anyone.
Well, I can start out the response by saying that that's a good question. First off, in that last week, or maybe even this week, we were reviewing, the core geophysicists are reviewing and commenting on a draft PWS statement for using classification in our work. This is an initiative that's been started by Nick Stolte in our office. We hope to have something that at least in the geophysics community and the core come to consensus on a relatively short time period. I know that DOD is along, or I think it's with the Munitions Response Dialogue, is also tackling or looking at this question. We expect to see some information from them as well. That's what I can offer from our side.
And I'll jump in here real quick, Brian Jordan here. From my side as a project manager on projects trying to employ this. We have already started incorporating it out of the Range Support Center into projects for the active installations or AEC models. So we're actually going to employ AGC at a former range that was just awarded. So there are already PWSs out there that are asking for AGC techniques and have AGC solutions. Now the next question is, when do we start incorporating that DADCAP language? And I'm already having that consultation with my customers about looking at the timeline for when we would actually get in the field to employ the technology. We probably will start needing to modify contracts to include DADCAP language and try to make sure we get the accredited services we're looking for.
So really, you know, what I'm hearing then, I mean, we're on the cusp of it. We're moving into that right now.
Correct.
Dwayne, go ahead, Ryan. I didn't mean to step over you.
And that would also include, I mean, with the recent developments in the UFP QAP for advanced geophysical classification, that would also need to be better defined as far as to make sure that we get the right quality elements in the deliverables to provide the level of comfort that we need for the regulators as well as for ourselves.
Andy, what were you gonna say?
Dwayne, I just need to add one very important point. A colleague of mine sitting in the room with me participating today was jabbing me in the ribs saying, Andy, you forgot to say the most important thing. This coming as a USACE question from the USACE district, the most important thing probably is to get a design center involved. Well, not probably. It is to get a design center involved. That's where the expertise resides.
All right. Excellent. Good job, John Sykes.
Oh, I thought for sure you were sitting with Patina.
I just made a stab at the John Sykes. I'm not sure who's sitting at the mothership, but that was my guess.
Bad guess.
Bad guess? Uh-oh. Let's see here. I'm having a cut-and-paste failure here, so excuse me here for just a second. Okay, this one's kind of interesting, and I'll pass this along to Jordan. But this is a good question here. Since DoD sees such great benefit from implementing DADCAP for classification, why are they not implementing similar accreditation program from other MMRP data requirements? You know, we make some of the same remedial decisions with our digital geophysics mapping and our MAG and FLAG data as we would with AGC data? Or is that something that DoD might pursue in the future for, you know, decisions based on DGM or M&F data?
So the quick answer is we are not seeking to establish accreditation programs for any of the other technologies at this point. And the reason why is, you know, remember from the case studies that were presented earlier today, you saw a significant amount of material that was being left in the ground based on this technology. And to have that level of confidence for us to be able to do so from the regulatory side of the house requires us to ensure that the contractors implementing technology are qualified to do this work and that they themselves operate under a quality system in which the data they produce can be historically reproduced and is defensible, and they're working on continual improvement. And so we do not seek that for the use of the other technologies, just based on the features associated with the use of this technology. It should also be noted that, you know, a lot of the initial demonstrations that ESTCP did really clearly identified the fact that proper user qualification was necessary to implement this technology successfully. And the accreditation program, a component of that, accomplishes the goal of ensuring that that's the case. And so that's the reason why it exists for advanced geophysical classification and why at this point we're not seeking to implement it on any of the technologies.
Okay, that makes sense. Here's a question, kind of a technical question. So I'll send this to Herb. What's the maximum number of targets a cued measurement can resolve?
Well, that's a tough one to answer definitively because it depends on what is the definition of a target. If there's one mortar or even a 37 and a bunch of fingernails, that's a lot different question than if there are a handful of similarly sized items. The sort of party line is between 3 and 4. I think most of the analysis methods these days, the most they attempt to solve for is 3 sources in underneath the footprint of the sensor. And if you sort of work back from those numbers, you get something like 4,000 anomalies per acre, which is where it becomes difficult to use these things. You don't get 4,000 by figuring out 3 per meter, but if you do 4,000 an acre and look at the distribution per meter curve, there's a significant number above 3 or 4 under the sensor at that anomaly density. So that's where we say you should probably not be doing this.
Okay. All right. Well, yeah, I think that gives everybody a feel for what's workable, what's doable. Good. Okay. Here's a question. Then I thought this was a very interesting question. Also, my company's classification proposal recently lost to a cheaper DGM-only proposal on a large multi-million-dollar contract award. You know, I'm confident my cost estimate is accurate and the cost to dig everything detected with DGM will be substantially higher than my proposal, where I would have been digging a lot less. What is the government going to do to guarantee cost reasonableness is factored in the award decision? And Andy, you want to tackle this one?
Thank you, Dwayne. Good question, difficult question. This came to our attention a couple of months ago, and I can say that I've had a couple of heated debates with a couple of folks in our organization about this. I wasn't very pleased when I heard about it. But about 6 weeks ago, I put this question to some of our legal and contracting people, chiefs here in Huntsville, and to be honest, don't really have a consensus yet. There's two central issues that I understand. One is, you know, how do we factor the risk attached to low dollar proposals with that in certain elements of a performance-based acquisition firm fixed price contract, and also when using a low price technically acceptable mechanism, you know, this becomes very problematic as well. I can tell you that I have participated in some recent contract actions where the risk component played a significant role in how we evaluated proposals, and that the more expensive proposals were viewed more favorably explicitly because they did not carry a significant risk to not being able to complete the work on time and on the budget that was proposed.
Okay. Good. Yeah, that is a, you know, that's a challenging one there for sure. Okay. When will UX Analyze support dynamic detection algorithms? Herb, do you have any info on that?
Yeah, I certainly have the plan. I think the rollout of that is supposed to be early in June of this year. NAOC and Geosoft are planning a NAOC-sponsored training course sometime in the middle to late June of the year, probably in Denver. I think they've arranged a room in Denver. If there are enough people, we'll probably do another session a little bit later in the year on the East Coast. So that's the plan, as I understand it, and that is time to support when people would be ready to go to the field to become accredited at the first opportunity.
Okay. Andy, I think you're probably a good one to try to tackle this one, and it's a very short question, but it may have a long answer. Can you achieve UUE with this technology?
Absolutely, and I'm going to go back to a discussion I held with, at the time, an EPA regulator, Kevin Oates, who later became one of my colleagues here at the CX. But when he was still heavily entrenched in EPA, I put this question to him in a very specific scenario where I could prove beyond a shadow of a doubt that at the time my EM61 metal detector technology could prove to him that I got all of the 2.36-inch rockets out of the near surface and that I could find them much deeper than they could than we found them. And he told me, in that kind of scenario, absolutely, we could entertain UUUE. And I will say that there is no difference between that scenario with an EM61 or the much more data-centric, quality control-centric solutions we get with classification data. I think we'll be able to get to at least open the door to these discussions with on a lot more sites. My personal view is we'll be able to open that door on a lot more sites than some people think. And time will tell whether I'm right or whether I'm wrong.
Okay. And I saw someone entered in the Q&A panel, and I should have I should have prefaced this. The UUUE, that stands for unlimited use, unrestricted exposure, or it may be unrestricted use, unlimited exposure. My dyslexia always causes me to transform those, but that's what it really means is unlimited use, unrestricted exposure. So, Andy, really what I'm hearing you say is that achieving UUUE is independent of the platform. It really depends on the confidence of the data that you've been able to collect.
Absolutely. Well, the confidence of the data you collect and what you find after you do the cleanup.
Correct.
You know, the actual scenario that you are presented with, you'll either be able to say, I'm at an endpoint where I can show with extremely high confidence that there's no UXO left, or there should be no UXO left, or I'm going to be in a scenario where I can't make that statement. In the
right,
former,
yeah.
I think we can entertain them, and in the latter, we can't.
Yeah, the data, the confidence in the data you collect, and your final conceptual site model.
Yes. Although some might argue it's no longer conceptual since you know so much about the site, but that's for a different webinar series. We can argue terminology.
There you go. Okay. Next question: How will DAGCAP be enforced contractually? And Jordan, do you have some ideas on this?
Yeah. So Kevin alluded to this a little bit earlier, but there has been discussions amongst at the DoD level and amongst the services about draft contract language that would sort of give the services examples of the kind of terms and how they would put it in their contracts. In Kevin's presentation, he clearly mentioned the fact that the DADCAP program is based on the DoD ELAP program, a laboratory program that we administer for the restoration side of the house. And we have contract language that implements that program. And so our vision is something similar to that to be pushed out. People can develop and use their own if they wanted to at this point, but we think it would be helpful for us to put that language together. And so we've already drafted some stuff up, and it's going around the review process. And this will be something that will be developed most likely from the DoD level so that all the services can utilize it in implementation.
Okay, great. Throw out the next question here. Some MMRP decision documents, they explicitly state that munitions debris has to be recovered as part of the selected remedy. So, you know, how in the world is a contractor supposed to propose classification for such a project? Andy?
Very creatively. I mean, I can see there's certainly some unique scenarios. I'm sure some of you heard me explain that, you know, if it's determined at a site that mortar fins or the mortar section, the fin section of a mortar would cause undue numbers of phone calls to the local sheriff or 911 hotline, that we want to identify those as TOI to be recovered at a site, you know, that in all likelihood would make sense. But if it's just a general statement, not knowing where this problem is, you know, the specifics, it's just if the statement is munitions debris in general, you probably can't propose this. I will say this, though, at least in the FUDS program, you should never see this kind of requirement. We're really sensitive to this at the CX, the documents, decision documents, and proposed plans, and for that matter, feasibility studies going backwards a bit, come through our office for review, and we have sent some back to some project teams that had language that might have led us to that kind of scenario, and we've sent it back to them saying that you need to change your language because we're not going to clean up things that clearly do not present a hazard.
Very good. Okay. Will accreditation, will that be based on what platform you use during the demonstration of capabilities? You know, if a company uses MetalMapper for the DOC, can they use TimTads on a project? Jordan, Kevin, what do you think about that?
Kevin, I can handle this if you'd like.
Yeah, because we talked about it earlier today.
Yeah. No, so the answer is that the accreditation is platform independent. So we're not – the scope of accreditation is going to be advanced geophysical classification. It's not going to be dependent on the equipment that that you've demonstrated with. And this runs counter, and Kevin mentioned this in his presentation, to what we do in the laboratory accreditation field where – the scopes of accreditation are actually quite complicated. They get down to analyte that you're measuring for. But for this accreditation, that's all we're doing. So the answer is whatever is used for demonstration, it's independent of what's going forward. You will obviously be required to have SOPs that cover the use of the technology that you intend on using.
Okay. That makes sense. If I'm a regulator, you know, what are the critical steps in the process that I should focus on from an oversight perspective to, you know, to gain confidence, to get the warm fuzzies that the process is working, you know, so that I can be confident in the outcome? Brian, Andy, what are your thoughts on this?
Brian, do you want to take a stab first? Because I wasn't prepared for this one. I was busy chatting with my colleague here.
I'm going to have him repeat it because I got people chatting at me. Go ahead.
Okay.
Sorry, Dwayne.
That's okay.
You know what, Dwayne? Is Fred still on the line? This might be a better question for Fred, to be honest with you, being from the regulator community.
Yeah, it kind of does tie into the questions I was asking Fred at the end of his presentation. I don't know, do we still have Fred? Are you out there, Fred?
No, if he is, he's on mute. I'll take a quick stab, and then we'll probably need to defer this because my answer may not be all that great. I would offer that, as we heard Fred say, the accreditation or the being accredited, having a quality system in place, demonstrating that everything is operating and functioning as designed and intended is in all likelihood going to be a key component, as well as the verification and validation digging processes that we have in place where we go and check all of our thresholds to make sure that our decisions are sound and we can show that they are. And, of course, recovering those seed items, both the ones that are completely blind to the project team and those that the project quality control people put in are going to be another really key point. Obviously, a failure on a seed is going to cause a regulator to cringe, and probably us as well. Finding all of them and correctly classifying them will add significant confidence that the system's working.
Okay. And Andy, this is Jordan. I was going to add one more thing, if that's okay.
Absolutely.
The process Andy discussed with the verification and validation processes are very clearly laid out in the Advanced Geophysical Classification Munitions Response QAP template. That template in its current form, which is as Kevin mentioned, it's about to be signed out by the EPA. That was really truly developed to garner regulatory buy-off on the use of this technology, and so all along the way, it has built into it the process for ensuring confidence in the results being performed. And the way that template is set up is it's got some minimum, we call the minimum recommended requirements in the document. And as part of the planning phase, the project team identifies clearly where they have changed from those minimum requirements. And that, just going through that process alone, is really designed to give the regulator the confidence that the work that's being performed will meet their requirements. And it really does design a use of the technology. And you heard this in many of the case studies that were given, where the technology itself is, and its implementation is designed to err on the side of conservatism in identifying TOI. And I think all that put together really enforces that and should give the kind of confidence that they need to go forward.
And you guys couldn't have said it better. Sorry, this is Fred on the line, Dwayne, and I just underscore what all those guys said, and every regulator that was on our team basically echoed the same sentiments.
Okay, perfect, perfect, good. Yeah, and Jordan, I'm glad you mentioned that, because that's what occurred to me also, was the UFP QAP templates that are being developed to support this. You know, that upfront process is really what, to me anyway, is what gives you the warm fuzzies that it's all going to turn out successful.
And Dwayne, I have sufficiently chastised my colleagues and myself, and I promise to pay better attention. Dwayne.
Okay. Here's one then. What's the detection depth, and does it vary between these AGC instruments? So, Herb, I haven't heard from you in a few minutes.
Well, I'm still here. So the detection depth, yeah, obviously does vary between instruments. Let's talk about the TEMTADS, which is mostly talked about today, or as we hear, it's going to be called the Metal Mapper 2x2. It has a transmit moment, which is measured in amps per meter squared, that is a little less than the EM61, so that really translates into small detectivity. It gains a little because the receivers are smaller, and that helps it back. But for medium-sized targets, 60-millimeter mortar-ish size targets, probably the EM61 can detect 5 or 10% deeper. So it's in the same neck of the same area of the woods. Metal Mapper has a little bit bigger transmitter coil and a little bit higher current, so it's probably the same or a little bit deeper than the EM61. The MPV, the handheld one that Amy showed earlier on, it's, of course, a much smaller coil, and since you're carrying it on your back, you can't have as much batteries and everything. So its detectivity is certainly a little bit lower.
Okay.
Herbert, I'd like to add one point that you sort of touched on, and that is the physical descriptions you just gave are absolutely correct, but one of the things that we haven't really quantified, but qualitatively I think gets us to equal or better than, at least for the TEMTADS, is the increased sensitivity in the electronics that are used. The noise levels are much lower, so we are able to detect signals that are much weaker that cannot be detected with the 61 simply because the electronics aren't capable of discerning them from its noise, whereas these new sensors have a much lower noise floor, allowing us to see things much clearer that to older technologies they can't see it.
Yeah, Andy, what you say is exactly correct. And the other thing I did not mention in addition to that, so I did a terrible job of answering this question. There are these advanced analysis methods, which we these days are calling informed source selection, which are not just treating the data as a pseudo-EM61 where you do peak picking or bump picking on a map, but in fact taking advantage of all the extra data to discriminate against that are available from these multi-axis, multi-coil sensors to discriminate against noise peaks. So that, as you say, Andy, helps you really beat down the noise. And then I've seen a lot of data where you can detect things deeper with a TEMTADS than an EM61, but using all these advanced techniques.
Okay, very good. I think we've got time. I'm going to try to squeeze in just a couple more questions that I think a lot of people are going to be interested in hearing. So here's one. You know, please discuss the prime subcontractor relationship. Who is it that has to be accredited? So Kevin and Jordan, What's your answer to this one?
I'll take this one. So actually, this has come up so many times, we had a frequently asked question, and I can't locate it right at the moment. Otherwise, I'd refer specifically to it for somebody to read. But any contract organization that's performing advanced geophysical classification, be they the prime, the sub, either has to be accredited or has to work under the quality system of the accredited entity that's out there doing the work. So it's not necessarily a matter of who's the prime and who's the sub. It's who's conducting that actual work relative to the whatever phase of the CERCLA process that's ongoing at the MRS. And in some manner, every one of those activities needs to, like I said, either be controlled as an accredited activity or somebody who supports that accredited organization working within the quality system, meaning that they're trained, that they're documented for demonstration of capability, and so on. I think that's kind of gets to the heart of it.
Okay. Yep. I agree. I think that answers that pretty clearly. Okay. Well, I'm going to do one last question because I believe this is something that quite a few members of the audience are very curious about. And how much does it cost to get accredited? And again, I'll ask Jordan and Kevin. Do y'all have any feel for this or any insider knowledge?
So I'm going to answer this one, Kevin.
Please.
We have two accreditation bodies that have been recognized to perform accreditations for this program. And any information that you would have about cost or availability, contacting them would be your best bet to get an answer. Those organizations are A2LA and LAB, and that information, as long as all the accreditation information, as Kevin alluded to earlier, will be posted on the EDKW's DENX website as an interim step until the DOD's munition response website gets their DICAP information posted. And so, yeah, that's your best bet is to contact those guys to get that information.
And as a bonus piece of information, that happens to be frequently asked question number one in the documentation that came along with the policy memo that will be placed where Jordan said. That's right up front is the contact information, not the cost, but the contact information for the ABs.
Ah, okay, good. So I should have led with that question then, right? That was FAQ number one. Good. Well, I'll tell you what, we have plowed through a lot of ground with these questions. Still have a handful that we could have gone even longer with. This is the first time that we've tried this panel discussion, and I've consumed all of our available time. But I really want to thank our panelists for doing this. I think this was outstanding information to share with everyone. I know that we didn't have the opportunity during this webinar to do as much of the Q&A on the individual presentations, but again, the materials are available to download from ClueIn, and as well as the speaker contact information. So if you have a question about a specific presentation, you know, please feel free to contact the speaker about that. We also had a question about whether the responses to these questions are going to be made available. And the short answer is that they are going to be available as part of the archive, the M2S2 archive. I don't know, we don't have any direct plans to try to transcribe answers to the questions and make them available. Now, that might be something that I do discuss with my colleagues later on to see if we want to have a sort of AGC FAQs that we're able to put out there. So I've used up all of our time. In fact, I've gone over just a little bit. We're about ready to wrap up for today's session, but I did want to, again, all of this was organized. Today's session was organized by the Huntsville Military Munitions Design Center, and so I wanted to offer Bettina Johnson, the chief of the Huntsville MMDC, a quick opportunity to make some closing remarks, and then we'll wrap it up with a few administrative things Gene and I will. So, Bettina, do we have you?
Yes, I'm here, Dwayne.
Excellent.
All right. So I just want to say a huge thank you to everyone who has participated today, both as a participant, also as a speaker today, our panel, and those who organized this webinar. A big shout out to Ralph Campbell. He actually helped me from the Chemical Warfare Material Design Center to take the lead for this effort and make sure everything was together with Dwayne Ford and that everyone was available. Search out for speakers and everyone who participated today. I hope you have learned even more about advanced classification, which I know I have. And I would love to see feedback, and I'm sure Dwayne would as well, on how you thought this webinar went, and I'm sure there's a way to do that. So please let us know. And we hope you participate in other webinars in the future that the panel here and other members and Dwayne has organized through this event. So thank you again for all your efforts, and we appreciate it.
Excellent. Thanks, Bettina. And just a couple of administrative things that I wanted to talk about before we adjourn for the day. One is, Bettina mentioned it, there's actually a way to, we have a survey, we have links that you can fill in survey and let us know what you thought about today's session, what went well, what didn't go so well, what we can improve on, ideas that you may have for future webinars, ton of information. We collect that information and we look at it. I mean, Jean can tell you that I pester her fairly regularly about the surveys to get that and work with it to continue to improve our webinars. I'm sure Jean will talk about the survey and how to access that here in just a second. I also wanted to mention, well, I've already mentioned the downloading materials. Those are available. We also have the archives and the speaker POC. One thing that I wanted to mention, and Jean may also talk about this also a little bit, for the next webinar coming up, which again is 4 August, we're going to have some new voices talking because I'm not going to be available for that webinar, and neither is Jean. So we're going to have a couple of new disembodied voices that are orchestrating the session. We are both planning to return, and we'll be here for the last one of the year on October 27th, but we won't be here. There'll be some new people, and we've already started the coordination with them. I'm sure it will still be an excellent, very successful webinar, but I just did want to mention that. And then the last thing that I wanted to ask, I'm going to throw it to Jean and say, Jean, can you wrap it up and also tell us what was our audience size today?
We'll be happy to walk through those final closing reminders for today's Military Munitions Support Services webinar. We did have just under 200 individuals participate live for today's broadcast, and we did draw an international audience today. So I'd like to echo the thanks not only to all of our organizers and instructors, but to those of you who were able to join us for today's live broadcast. As Dwayne noted, there is a method for submitting feedback for today's live broadcast. We shared that link in the Q&A window. You'll see a direct link to both the place where you can download copies of the presentation materials, but also fill out feedback. That's also prominently located under the related URLs page on the middle right of your page. As Dwayne noted, we do read each and every one of your responses, and we count on your feedback to continue to offer these free online sessions. One of the benefits of filling out the feedback form is you can actually obtain a participation certificate. We've been testing out a new webinar certificate on Cluin this year, and in order to obtain one of these certificates, you need to submit feedback for the event or for the archived version. So if you're watching the recorded version, you can still fill out that feedback form and obtain one of these participation certificates. At the bottom of the feedback form, there's a box you can check, and you have to make sure to check that box. If you don't check that box, there will not be a certificate generated. The box, when you check it, essentially verifies you participated in the whole session, and that's what will produce the certificate. You will immediately be able to download or print the certificate, and we'll also email it to you as a PDF attachment. We welcome to hear your feedback about these certificates, again, just documenting your participation and the length of time of the webinar. So we continue to look forward to your input to improve this particular tool and start applying it on future deliveries. So again, as Dwayne noted, slides are available. Contact information for all of our organizers and instructors can be found on the seminar homepage. And please, please, please take a moment to fill out that short online feedback form. If you share the line as a group, each person can actually hop on and fill out their own version of the feedback form and get their own certificate from that page. So thank you all so very much to the nearly 200 individuals who joined us for today's live broadcast. We hope that you found this to be a valuable expenditure of your time. And each of you will be receiving an email shortly as soon as today's archive is available for free replay and download. As noted, I won't be here in August, but I look forward to carrying on the webinar series in my absence. I think you'll have a great time with the two new co-hosts who will be joining in August, but Dwayne and I will be back to carry on in the fall. So thank you all so very much for joining us. This will be the formal conclusion for today's live broadcast.